You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Thomas Lindsay, who is an attorney and the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, a nonprofit law firm that has provided free legal services to over 500 local governments and nonprofit organizations since 1995. He's a cum laude graduate of Widener Law School and a three-time recipient of the law school's Public Interest Law Award. He has been a finalist in the Ford Foundation's Leadership for a Changing World Award, a recipient of the Pennsylvania Farmers Union's Golden Triangle Legislative Award, co-founder of the Daniel Pennock Democracy School, now taught in 24 states across the country, which has graduated over 5,000 lawyers, activists, and municipal officials, and which assists groups to create new community campaigns which elevate the rights of those communities over the rights claimed by corporations. Lindsay's books include Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community. He was featured in the Leonardo DiCaprio and Tree Media film 11th Hour and We the People 2.0. He assisted the Ecuadorian Constitutional Assembly in 2008 to adopt the world's first constitution recognizing the independently enforceable rights of ecosystems. Thomas Lindsay, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, David.
It's quite a bio. We can't get to all of it. Let's try starting with tell us about the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
Sure. So the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is a public interest law firm that we created back in 1995. And we created it back in 1995 to do something quite different than what we do today. Essentially, back then, we set ourselves up as a conventional, traditional environmental law firm. And we litigated cases under the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and did permit appeals and basically everything that traditional environmental lawyers do today. And then after doing that for about 7 or 8 years, we became very disillusioned with how environmental law is practiced. Essentially, environmental law has nothing to do with helping communities actually stop projects at the local level, but more with making those projects cause a little less harm when they come in the door. And with an understanding that the community itself doesn't have any authority whatsoever if the state or federal government has permitted a corporate project like a factory hog farm or a frack job or a frack wastewater injection well or toxic waste incinerator. That once the state or federal government has issued a permit for that project, that the community itself, and by community we mean municipalities, so the city, town, village, county, whatever that municipality may be, is then stripped of any authority to say no or to veto the project at the local level. So we came to grips with the fact that we have a system of law that is very anti-democratic when it comes to communities making decisions about what their communities are going to look like 20, 40, or 60 years in the future, and that power increasingly has been shifted to the corporations that are proposing those projects that come into those municipalities. And so the shift that we did was to give up on environmental law as really being about stopping anything in these communities. And we transitioned instead to assisting these communities to begin drafting their own laws. And these are laws that not only ban particular activities within those communities, like fracking or toxic waste incinerators or whatever, but that also take aim at the legal doctrines that guarantee that the corporation has more decision-making authority than the community itself. So the laws are more than laws. They're actually challenges, direct challenges, to a system of law that elevates corporate rights above the rights of the people that live in those communities. And along the way, we've pioneered a legal theory, a new theory, which actually has its roots in the 1800s in some ways, that communities and people within those communities have a constitutional right of local community self-government, that they have a constitutional right to govern themselves, and that includes the right to say no to these projects that are harmful.
And when you use the word community, do you mean a group of humans or do you mean something more than that?
Well, we mean both, both the communities of humans as well as the biotic community, so the environmental community. And at a 30,000-foot level, the work that we do is really about redefining what community means. So when a toxic waste incinerator is siting within a community, the impacts from that incinerator are not just felt by the human community, the humans that live in that city, town, village, or county, but also by the natural environment itself. And so the work that we do, I think, can loosely be described as self-determination. In other words, assisting communities of humans to self-determine, but also a deeper understanding that nature today under Western civilized law is treated as property, which means that if you have a deed for a piece of property, basically you can do whatever you want to it, including destroying the ecosystems that are found on that piece of property. And so as part of that quest towards self-determination that our human communities have been making, I think there's a realization that nature has to possess a right to self-determine as well. So that rivers have a right to flow and forests have a right to exist. And I think along the way, we're reclaiming in some ways what it means to be human as interconnected and dependent upon these other systems to a point where we're forcing the legal system to recognize rights for those environmental systems as well as for rights of those humans to decide what their futures look like.
I imagine you run into people around the United States and probably some listening to this program who think that it actually makes more sense to give rights to corporations than to ecosystems or future generations or a human right to the commons or anything that might protect the world around us. What's your view of giving rights to corporations? Because that's the one that seems crazy to me.
Yeah, so corporations have possessed certain constitutional rights for a long time in this country, all the way back to the mid-1800s. Some people track it even back to the early 1800s and beyond. And in fact, those corporate rights have a pedigree. They're anchored back in English common law. In fact, some writers like Professor Adam Winkler out of UCLA has tracked it all the way back to Roman times. Where vestiges of corporate forms can be found. So corporate rights go way back. The reason why corporate rights in our constitutional context don't make any sense is because corporations are property. So I can create a corporation tomorrow and sell it to you because the corporation is a piece of property. It exists on paper. And because of that, giving rights or recognizing rights for corporations would be akin to your refrigerator having rights. And unfortunately, things having rights under this system come with a cost, which is that corporations having rights can sue you. So you can have a corporate entity as a plaintiff suing you for, or more explicitly or precisely, suing a local government or a state government or a federal government for denying those corporate constitutional rights. So we've always found that situation to be fairly anomalous, that it doesn't make sense under our constitutional system in which rights are intended only for natural persons, natural breathing human persons under the U.S. Constitution. But in this weird, wacky system of law that we have in the United States, corporations have rights, nature doesn't. Corporations have rights. People living in their own communities don't have equivalent rights to those corporations that are attempting to use them for resource extraction or for various projects. And I'll also say that a lot of people track corporate rights back to a series of Supreme Court decisions in the United States. And, of course, as I mentioned, the pedigree for corporate rights goes much further back than that. But at the same time, our U.S. Constitution made it very easy for corporations in the United States to obtain those rights through the court, because in many ways the U.S. constitutional structure itself, aside from the Bill of Rights, so when most people extol the Constitution, they're talking about the Bill of Rights, and we forget that the Bill of Rights had to be driven in by a revolution of its own, by the anti-federalists who wanted to drive a Bill of Rights into the constitutional construct against the wishes of the Madisons Jeffersons and the Hamiltons and the other founding fathers. So it took a revolution itself by people to drive the Bill of Rights in. But when most people extol the Constitution, they're talking about the Bill of Rights. Unfortunately, the text of the Constitution is really what's become known as a property and commerce document, which elevates the rights of property and commerce above the rights of people, communities, and nature. And so when people say, well, how does that make sense? It must have been an accident that corporations obtained constitutional rights like free speech and freedom of religion and freedom to associate and all the other rights under the Bill of Rights that we have that people have today. The answer is that it's not an exception. It's not an accident that it was very easy for corporations to fit themselves into that constitutional structure, because the U.S. constitutional structure is a lot about protecting property and commerce, and not so much about protecting people, communities, and nature.
Although some people were property back at the time it was written. We're speaking with Thomas Lindsay, who is the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Just briefly, I'm very interested in the Constitution in Ecuador and your role in that and how it's working out in the early years of its existence. Are ecosystems' rights being protected?
Yeah, the answer is a mixed bag, but to take us back to 2007, we had some of the first communities in the United States, like a little place called Tamaqua Borough, which is an hour and a half west of Philadelphia, passed some of the first rights of nature laws in the world. So these were local laws passed by cities, towns, villages, counties that recognized nature as having rights. So this huge, you know, concept that's paradigm changing in Western civilized law or Western civilization law at this point, that this groundbreaking concept was really pioneered by local municipalities. So local governments that you might not necessarily think of as being very progressive were the first ones to pioneer this new vantage point for the law, recognizing that ecosystems have certain rights within those municipalities. And because of that work in the United States, some folks in Ecuador, including some members of the Constitutional Assembly there who were writing a new constitution, saw what was happening in those small municipalities and wanted to replicate some of that work into the national constitution for Ecuador. And so we were called to travel down to Ecuador to meet with the Constitutional Assembly to tell them about some of the stories about what was happening in the United States, and to help them imagine what that might look like for the federal constitution. And the Ecuadorian delegates to the Constitutional Assembly decided to incorporate the rights of nature concept into the Ecuadorian constitution, passed overwhelmingly in an initiative, a referendum within the country, and actually became the new constitution for Ecuador. And then the next step was to begin to enforce those provisions. So the Ecuadorian constitutional provisions recognize that ecosystems and nature within Ecuador have a right to exist, flourish, regenerate, be restored, those types of rights. And the question was, what does that look like in a court of law? And the first case that was brought under those constitutional provisions dealt with a river called the Vilcabamba River in Ecuador, and dealt with a lawsuit in which the river was defending itself against the dumping of the construction debris into the river, which was changing its flow. And the argument was that that dumping of construction debris into the river violated the rights of the river to exist and flourish and be restored, and the rights, other rights that are in the Ecuadorian Constitution. And so it kind of bends our brains sometimes to think about what rights of nature, the impact is on the conventional jurisprudence or judicial system that we have. But in this case, the Vilcabamba River was the plaintiff.
Right.
So when you have nature possessing rights that up till now have not been seen by the courts, that you're making them visible to the courts, that the plaintiff is actually the ecosystem. And so the case was captioned Vilcabamba River versus the province of Loja, which was the local government that was dumping the construction debris in. And long story short, the judge ruled in favor of the river. It was the first rights of nature case in the world. In which the judge ruled on behalf of the river. There have been other cases in Ecuador dealing with illegal gold mining, shark fin fishing off of the Galapagos, other cases that have built around those rights of that are contained Constitution, and perhaps even more exciting than that, though that's very exciting to us, is that other courts in other parts of the world, like Colombia and India, have actually issued rulings that borrow from that Ecuadorian experience, ruling that the Amazon region, for example, is a legal person that has a certain rights under the law. And they do so not because in India and Colombia they have those same written constitutional provisions as Ecuador, because they don't, but they're building a new body of jurisprudence completely through judge-made law that borrows from those examples from Ecuador and other places. So I think it's a very interesting time for this concept of rights of nature to be building, because it's not only building through legislation, but also building through judges borrowing from other judges' decisions on an international level.
It's wonderful. It's exciting. I think I got in touch with you, Thomas Lindsay, because I'd been familiar to some degree with this work that you've been doing over the years, but also because I would just recently was handed something called the James River Natural Community Bill of Rights. And here I am in Virginia near the James River, and I was very curious how this came about and what it might amount to. Can you give me part of that story?
I can briefly to the amount that we've been involved with it, but we've made several visits to parts of Virginia. I grew up in southwestern Virginia, and just like communities across the United States in Colorado, Washington, Oregon, in different places where they're looking for new tools to do ecosystem protection, there's a group of individuals there who are exploring using this rights of nature concept to protect the James River. And also using ecosystem rights to protect places like the Shenandoah and the Roanoke River and other what we would call big-name ecosystems that may have some form of protection under the law, but not the elevated form of protection that rights of nature would recognize. I mean, this is essentially about grounding nature's rights in a constitutional context, which is a much higher form of protection than some of the protection already given to natural ecosystems and the environment. And, of course, as we've seen both in national forests and in state-protected areas, we now have pipelines being laid across those regions because those types of environmental protection measures are not strong enough to protect them from those types of invasions. We still have national forests being used for all kinds of extraction activities, the multi-use stuff like clear cutting. I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which the environment is being degraded. And in fact, we're at a worse place now than we were 40 years ago when the major environmental laws were passed, because by almost every major environmental statistic, things are worse now today than they were 40 years ago. So I think it's natural that people are looking for other ways to protect those ecosystems. I think the James River has been under attack for a long, long time, as long as the Colorado River has been in Colorado. And there was a groundbreaking lawsuit brought this past year in the name of the Colorado River against the state of Colorado for bartering away the water before it even reaches the end of the Colorado River. So I think it's great what they're thinking about doing in Virginia. Virginia happens to be a very tough state to move local lawmaking forward in, but that shouldn't be a stopper for folks to want to put this new system of protection in place.
And that's been an issue you've dealt with for years in Pennsylvania, correct? The question of what localities can do, what powers they can claim for themselves versus the state legislature or the federal government.
Absolutely. So municipalities in this country, so the municipal corporations that we think of as cities, villages, towns, and counties, which are corporations of their own. So like in southwestern Virginia, the city of Blacksburg only has certain powers that are given to it by the state legislature. So for a long time, our municipalities have been treated as second-class citizens. And I think you're seeing a change to some of that with the friction between on the sanctuary city issue now with the Trump administration. The marijuana stuff has always been a friction point, at least between states and the federal government, as well as in some cases localities and the federal government. And so I think you're seeing some of that friction now starting to slowly change in the other direction. But make no doubt about, you know, for the last 200 years, municipalities have been completely subordinate to state legislatures. It's why the state legislature can preempt municipalities from making law in a bunch of different areas. So, like, 20 states now have preempted municipalities from passing laws dealing with genetically modified organisms or genetically modified seeds from being planted. So when localities have begun moving in a certain direction to make law, states, which are essentially controlled and manipulated by some of the largest economic interests in this country, are then used as an apparatus to tamp that down at the municipal level. We've come to grips with that in a number of places. Virginia is one of the worst. Virginia is one of the worst centralized states in which municipalities have almost no power to operate independently of the state. And like I said, we think that needs to change. In many places, you have a bunch of options. You can either run a law through your local elected officials and try to get it passed that way. You can do initiative lawmaking. So in some cities, they have provided the power to people to circulate petitions and put something on the ballot for a vote. And in other places, including Pennsylvania, as one example, the people of municipalities have the ability to rewrite their own local constitution. So they're called home rule charters. But the power is given to people to actually put on the ballot the question of writing a new constitution for the locality. And so while in some states you have a bunch of different options, in places like Virginia, which are very centralized, you have almost none. And so there's a big discrepancy between if you live in one state versus another, what kind of rights you have in terms of democratic lawmaking. And so we've kind of become the assistance ladder for communities across the United States who, first of all, want to do something because they see something wrong with the current system. And then we assist them with the vehicles of how to actually get that done. And then we come in at their request to represent them in the case of a lawsuit. And lawsuits are almost automatic under this system. When a community says we don't want a toxic waste incinerator and the company wants to put one in and the law is on the side of the company, that generally this breeds lawsuits. And the lawsuits are filed seeking not only to overturn the law that's been passed by the locality, but also for damages against the locality. Because under the law, the corporation can seek not only to overturn the law, but also seek money damages for the amount of lost profits lost as a result of the passage of the law at the local level. So, you know, when I go out and give talks about this kind of stuff, people are horrified because you don't really see how the system of law operates unless you're in the midst of it. And at any one time, there aren't that many people compared to the overall population who are in the midst of fighting a giant corporation coming in to put something into their community. But the reality is that we are slaves in a much different sense than slavery in the 1800s. But we're enslaved to a system in which even when a majority of people within our communities come together and say, we don't want that 20,000-head hog factory farm in the middle of our community, that we are powerless to actually say no to that because of the way that the legal system has been engineered over the past 150 years. So what I think is happening right now, whether it's in Virginia around the James River, or these 200-plus communities that have passed laws saying no to these projects coming into their municipalities, is we're seeing a revolt. It's a revolt at a grassroots level, which is beginning to push its way up, to say, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to get on our knees in front of the state regulators begging and pleading agencies to do the right thing. We're not going to fight it out in courts on a ground that the corporations have chosen. We're not going to put up with frack wells being sited in our community anymore. And when that happens, I think that's very exciting. There's a kind of civil disobedience that is that laced through this lawmaking process in which it's not just individuals lying down in front of bulldozers. It's actually whole communities who are seizing their municipal structures to then turn it upwards against the state and the corporation. And I think in a very real way, that's some of the more radical work that's starting to happen at the municipal level as people come to grips with a system that's destroying not only their community but also the planet.
We got just about 3 minutes left. Thomas Lindsay, there are already some municipalities that have done this, right, that have rewritten their constitutions, have created rights for nature, and have stripped corporations of rights within their localities.
Yes, altogether, over 200 municipalities in 10 states so far have passed these kinds of laws that have those characteristics to them.
It's remarkable. And we mentioned Ecuador, but additional countries, Bolivia and others, are pursuing this same idea at the national level, right, with legislation.
Yep. And a couple years ago, we established the International Center for the Rights of Nature, headed up by a woman named Mari Margill, who's our associate director for the Legal Defense Fund. And she's currently working with folks in India, the Philippines, Nepal, basically these pockets of folks internationally who have seen the rights of nature both on paper and as practice now in Ecuador and the decisions coming out of India and Colombia, in addition to those international pockets which are moving forward constitutional amendments and national statutes. So in India, the rights of the Ganges River, for example, is a statute that we've written that's now beginning to wend its way through the Indian Assembly, and so Indian legislature. And so these international pockets are moving. In the United States, tribes are now moving. Tribal communities have more room to roam in terms of sovereignty than some of the municipal communities that we deal with. So the Ho-Chunk tribe in Wisconsin was the first to take a vote, putting rights of nature into their tribal constitution. A tribal constitution, and that's starting to happen in different places in the United States with different tribes that we've been asked to help with. And, of course, indigenous peoples have treated nature as something other than property for thousands of years. And it's just now that our culture is catching up with the need for that rights-based kind of approach to ecosystem protection.
Indeed. 60 seconds left. How can people get involved, learn more, find out how to make this happen in their locality?
So best way is to access our webpage, which is at celldef.org. That stands for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.org. And if their interest is in the rights of nature, we have a rights of nature workshop that we do for communities. There's some of the ones that we've done in Virginia. And if the interest is in community self-determination for saying no to certain projects like pipelines and those types of things, we do a two-day training called Democracy Schools. And attendees include lawyers and municipal officials, community leaders. And we actually go through a process of teaching history and then coming up to the present day, looking at strategy, language, ordinances, those types of things. So it depends on how people want to plug in, but the webpage is the best way.
Wonderful, wonderful work. Thank you for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio. Thomas Lindsay is the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Thanks for coming on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, surrounded by reporters eager to talk about the cancellation of the White House visit and new NFL policy about standing during the national anthem, Malcolm Jenkins, safety for Super Bowl winners, the Philadelphia Eagles, chose not to speak, instead holding up signs with information on racism in the criminal justice system and community work players are doing. Before the anthem even started, players were involved in these types of social justice issues, Jenkins said afterward. And so for us, it's staying on topic, doing the work, supporting those who are doing the work, and pushing forward. The work Jenkins is talking about is the topic of a timely new book by journalist Howard Bryant. It's called The Heritage: Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN.com and author of a number of books, including Shut Out, A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston. We'll talk with Howard Bryant today on Counterspin. But first, we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. The latest example of what FAIR analyst Adam Johnson calls Trump washing, the disturbing tendency of some media to rehabilitate some of the most vile reactionary forces on the American right simply because they say vaguely negative things about Donald Trump, is retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. Peters was a longtime presence at Fox News, where he got to rail against Islam and Black Lives Matter and Barack Obama, and to generally share the worldview reflected in the headline of a piece he wrote for The Wall Street Journal, Civilian Casualties, No Apology Needed. Peters has even argued for military attacks on the partisan media. In other words, the killing of journalists who criticize the state. And yes, he means in this country. I just read the essay in the Journal of International Security Affairs. But Peters quit Fox in March, calling it a pro-Trump propaganda machine. And for this, he got write-ups in the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Daily Beast, to name a few. Now that this bigoted warmonger dislikes Trump for being mean to his friends in the intelligence community, he can find a home again on CNN as a respectable, reasonable Republican, that most cherished of endangered species. Peter's appearance on Anderson Cooper 360 was lauded, even as he offered as explanation, quote, "For years, I was glad to be associated with Fox. It was a legitimate conservative and libertarian outlet, and a necessary one. But with the rise of Donald Trump, Fox did become a destructive propaganda machine, and I don't do propaganda for anyone." Close quote. So, Fox's years of inciting anger against immigrants, defaming the poor, smearing Black activists and Muslims, not just good, but necessary. But now that the network's doing all these things, plus boosting Trump, it's crossed the line. Well, you might say Trump opponents need all the help they can get, but we have to challenge whether checking off one box should erase a career's worth of top-down hate mongering, such that when cable producers have these folks on, they don't even clue viewers in on what else they stand for. And before one is tempted to say that all you need to do these days to get on centrist liberal cable news is to be anti-Trump, remember that that would mean making room for actual leftists. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When Colin Kaepernick wanted to join thousands of other Americans in expressing his outrage and sorrow at the killing of Black people by police, the San Francisco 49er spoke with, among others, Nate Boyer, another football player for the Seattle Seahawks, who was a Green Beret. Boyer suggested that rather than sit out the national anthem, Kaepernick take a knee. The way, he said, soldiers take a knee in front of a fallen brother's grave, as a way to express dissent without disrespect for the military or veterans. That critics, including in the press, would describe Kaepernick's gesture as a refusal to stand, an insolent refusal to act, rather than inaction, consciously chosen, is telling. much as many people still believe Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus because her feet were tired. Like Parks, Kaepernick is in fact engaged in thoughtful political action. In his case, the particular expression of political action that African-American athletes have engaged for decades, known informally as the heritage. That history and its meaning in the present moment is the subject of a new book, The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism, out now from Beacon Press. Our next guest is its author. Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. He's also author of, among other titles, Shut Out, A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston, and The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. He joins us now by phone from Massachusetts. Welcome to Counterspin, Howard Bryant.
Thank you, Janine. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Well, I appreciate the way that the book enmeshes sports history in social history. 3 days after Michael Jordan's NBA debut in 1984 was the day the NYPD killed Eleanor Bumpers, a 66-year-old black woman with mental illness, for instance. Generally, the media separates sports, literally and figuratively, from everything else that's happening. It's an escape. It's a different world. And key to the story you tell, sports, Americans tell themselves, is a meritocracy. We may have racial injustice in society, but by golly, on the field, all that matters is can you run or throw or hit. This idea that the job of the black athlete is in some ways to advertise U.S. equality, that's there from the beginning of the history of the heritage, isn't it?
It sure has been. And I think one of the things that's been really interesting in trying to figure out how to tell this type of story, because there's so much to it, is where do you start and how do you put this together? And for me, the genesis of this had been this revival of this heritage. If you're of a certain age, you remember Muhammad Ali and you remember the memories, of course, of Jackie Robinson, and you remember Bill Russell and all of these athletes, John Carlos, Tommy Smith in the 68 Olympics. You remember these players being very prominent, and you remember them being advocates for African Americans. If you're of a different generation, if you were, say, born in the 80s or even the 90s, this revival, the appearance of athletes taking a political stance, being involved in their community, being involved in social issues on a national level, is completely foreign. Because you grew up with the Michael Jordans and Tiger Woods being the model. So for me, what I thought was really sort of interesting and important was to remind people that the black athlete has been involved in the political struggle from the beginning, and that these players have had a very special place in American history. The argument that I make in the book is that the black athlete is the most important and most influential and most visible black employee in the 20th century, because they're the ones who were allowed to integrate the society, whether it was the military, whether it was education, whether it was swimming pools. It was the ball players who came first. And because of that, they've had a responsibility to stand up and to advocate. So we recognize them when they're not there, and we remember them when they are.
And with that comes this bind, you know, this visibility as a real representation of integration and yet still being a black American. And in terms of the history and the beginning, I think a lot of folks would be very, very surprised to hear that it starts with Paul Robeson.
Absolutely. It starts with Paul Robeson. And, of course, people don't realize that he played in the National Football League. He played football before he was the great baritone, before he was the great singer and the great actor and the great activist. And one of the only reasons that he left professional football was because the National Football League was integrated and then it chose segregation until 1946. So when he played 1921 and 1922, football was integrated. And then by 1923, no blacks were allowed to play in the NFL for another quarter century. It wasn't just Robeson to me that I gravitated toward when tracing this heritage. It was also the fact that the African-American athlete's political roots did not start with black issues. started with Jewish issues. It started with World War II. It started with American athletes being asked to defend America against Nazism and Jewish athletes asking for solidarity against the Berlin Olympics in 1936. And also, of course, asking Jackie Robinson to denounce Paul Robeson in 1949 in support of America during the Cold War. So it wasn't until much later, it wasn't until you had Robinson in that testimony receive all the attention for his denouncing of Paul Robeson, but also inside of that testimony, he talked about inequality and police brutality and mistreatment of African Americans and fairness and all of these things that would become the foundations of this heritage. It started with Robinson, but not along racial lines to begin with. It started with defending America.
I find Robinson's HUAC testimony to be maybe the most moving part of the book and such a clear, first of all, a thing that's so misremembered.
Completely.
You know.
We chose to emphasize the part that made America feel good.
Right.
Which was, see, Jackie Robinson is a real American because he denounced Paul Robeson, the bad Negro communist. I don't even think we misremembered everything. We just chose to ignore it. And when I started to read that testimony when I was doing the research, I was wondering, did I know this? I think I kind of knew this, but maybe I really didn't either.
Right.
And that's what we do. We decide to omit. One of the great favorite colleagues and the great writer, David Marinus, once said to me that history writes people out of the story, and it's our job to write them back in. And I think that Robinson testimony is something that needed to be written back in.
Absolutely. Well, you know, history's moving along, and owners and teams are aware that integration is happening, but I like how you note that this idea that became popular and still holds sway that, oh, they're only looking for the best players, that was fiction always. And there's this note that Earl Wilson, when Earl Wilson was signed to the Boston Red Sox, the scouting report described him as a, quote, well-mannered colored boy, not too black, pleasant to talk to, close quote.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this story of integration, but then Black athletes are making money, and some of them are making a tremendous amount of money. And so that gives them a bigger megaphone and at the same time more calls not to use it.
For caution, absolutely. And I think that's this tension that the Black athlete has that even other Black entertainers don't have. Why are we now talking about Oprah Winfrey as a potential presidential candidate? Because she has money. And we talk about Mark Cuban as a presidential candidate, or Donald Trump as president, or Michael Bloomberg as the mayor of New York because they were all rich. When it comes to the Black athlete, though, what we want from them in exchange for the money is silence. We don't want to hear from them. We want them to be quiet. We want them to shut up and play or shut up and dribble. And this is the one area where money is not affording you a bigger voice. And that goes back to this very interesting relationship that we tend to have with our sports figures, that there's an ownership to them that they don't necessarily get to be citizens, that their job is to entertain us. And I think that's one of the areas where this heritage has become so polarizing in a lot of ways, is this feeling of ownership is now colliding with the fact that you have this new generation of Black athletes, post Trayvon Martin, post Ferguson, post Eric Garner and Sandra Bland, who are now citizens, especially thanks to the prevalence of social media. They're watching these viral videos just like the rest of us are on YouTube, and they're looking at this dash cam footage. And one of the things that one of the players, Tavon Austin, had said, who played for the St. Louis Rams when he came out in 2014 with the hands-up, don't-shoot gesture before a game, was, it's hard for me to go back to my community knowing that this is going on, knowing that I've got a platform, and all my friends and family are looking at me going, people listen to you and you're not saying anything. That's the heritage.
Well, one of the things that happens in between, you know, the 60s, obviously, and the present moment, a big thing that happens is September 11th, 2001.
Absolutely. 9/11 is the key to me. And once again, we talk about generations. If you are of a certain generation, if you're from my generation, I was born in 1968, if you're of my generation, you were shaped by the Cold War. The Olympics were charged, obviously, because of the United States and the USSR. Everything was Cold War-based, whether it was an arms race, whether it was sports, no matter what it was, you were shaped along the framework of the United States and the Russians. if you were born in 1985 or 1990, you were 10 or 11 years old or 15, 16 years old on September 11th. So therefore, the packaging of sports, this is what you know. This is all you know. If you're my son, who was born in 2004, this is how he sees the society being sold, packaged through flags and flyovers and soldiers and nationalism and support of the troops and the conflation of police with military. And so now when you watch a sporting event, on the one hand, you see flags and you see police singing the national anthem and you see camera shots of all of this law enforcement and you have dozens of law enforcement appreciation nights at the ballpark. And at the same time, you have LeBron James talking about police brutality and Carmelo Anthony walking arm in arm with his fellow Baltimore natives after Freddie Gray was killed. And so you've got this collision between post 9/11 packaging and selling of sports at the ballpark and the post-Ferguson black athlete. And that's really at its core what this book is about.
Well, and when we talk about selling, as you make clear in the book, immediately post September 11th, a lot of it really was selling. It really was the Defense Department using these sporting events to recruit.
Absolutely. 100%. I had a conversation with the three-star general, Russell Honoré, who was tremendous in trying to get the cleanup and the restoration after Hurricane Katrina back on track after all of that disaster. And the general and I had a very long conversation about this, about the Pentagon using sports as a recruiting tool and the sports leagues themselves charging the National Guards and the Department of Defense to put on these inauthentic displays of patriotism, whether it was the surprise homecomings or the flags or the singing of God Bless America, that all of these different services were essentially, or these different acts were being charged as services by the sports teams to the National Guards across the country. And they didn't tell anybody. It was a deception. And it wasn't until John McCain and Jeff Flake, the two Arizona Republicans, senators came out with their report talking about how inauthentic and what a deception this was, that taxpayer dollars were being used for these sort of phony displays. And I asked the general, and I said, well, you know, maybe I just want my 12-year-old to be a kid. Maybe when he goes to a Red Sox game, I just want him to enjoy the game, and that's it. I don't want him to be surreptitiously recruited by the Army. General Honoré said, well, that's too bad. I tell the parents, hold on to those little SOBs as long as you can, because we need them to man the force. And maybe there's going to be some kid who goes to a Dallas Cowboys game and looks up and sees an F-14 flying over before the game. You know, that's going to motivate him to join the service. That's where we are right now. And so one of the interesting sort of reactions that I've gotten from this has been twofold. One is, well, yeah, the Army should do this. This is what we need to do. This is where we are. Another response has been, well, okay, paid patriotism is a deception. There's no question about that, that it's not organic. We know that these teams are taking money, and we know that. But it's a harmless deception because it's for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be so incongruous, that if it's for the right reasons, if it's supposed to be noble, then why are we deceiving the public? It's a really interesting place we're in right now.
And who's getting to decide that is the right reason?
And who gets to decide? And that's the other thing I very much enjoyed in the book, especially in the middle chapters. The original title of this book was War Games. It was not The Heritage. It was War Games. It was, I think the subtitle was the Players, the Flag, and Protest in a Militarized America. That was the original title. But as we started to go back and I began to realize, okay, I didn't want to assume how much of this heritage people knew, I realized that I had to kind of keep it to the ballplayers, and I put the war game section of the book in the middle. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about this section was talking to veterans and hearing veterans say, we don't want to be treated as props. And Chapter 7 of the book is titled Props, where veterans talk about not wanting to be used by these sports teams to sell camo jerseys and to sell their sports teams and to make billionaires even richer. The players themselves, some of them have issues with it, but the veterans are the ones who, to me, are really the conscious of those sections because they know better. They don't want to be used by these billion-dollar sports teams to sell a product.
Well, yeah, this is social history. I hope folks won't pick it up looking for, you know, play-by-plays.
There's no play-by-play in this.
But then, as you've said, there is this conflation that happens of the military with the police, and that brings us to today. But then this funny idea that folks like Kaepernick, that folks who take a knee, that when LeBron wears an I Can't Breathe shirt, that that is introducing politics into sports.
That's right. And that is a very interesting dance that people have negotiated with themselves. That when you see Colin Kaepernick, in fact, ESPN hired a focus group with the Republican Frank Lutz, Republican pollster Frank Lutz, and Lutz went and asked the people in this focus group, because the ratings went down dramatically whenever there were images of Colin Kaepernick on the field. And he would ask them, why was the reaction to Kaepernick so visceral and so strong? And their reaction was, well, we don't want politics in our sports. And then Lutz said to the focus group, well, that's a little disingenuous, isn't it? Because the ratings went very high when we showed you flags and we showed you soldiers and you saw jets and things at the ballpark. And the reaction from the focus group was, well, that's not politics, that's patriotism. So the sports fan has made a negotiation. They've actually partitioned politics from patriotism. And they believe this, even though I don't think there's anything more political than a country's flag.
I guess as a critic, I do lay some of this at media's feet. I always remember a quote from USA Today, which I wish I had in front of me, but it was about people demonstrating about trade agreements. And they said that these agreements, although they haven't interested the public, they've galvanized activists around the world. And I love that sort of linguistic sleight of hand where, as the public, you know, fine, you can have an opinion, but once you get together with others, once you go out in the street, once you demonstrate an opinion, well, you're an activist. And
no, you're still a citizen.
Yeah.
You're still the public. It's the same thing.
Well, I want to highlight how many stories in the book are not, you know, Colin Kaepernick. There's Tony Smith Thompson, the college basketball player who turned her back on the anthem in 2002. There's the Detroit Piston, whose name's escaping me, who went on a hunger strike in 93.
Olden Polynice.
Olden Polynice, exactly. But in a way, the heritage is about, like, the bigger the spotlight, in a way, on the athlete, and what do they do with it, you know? So now we're in 2018. The NFL's response to Cap versus Trump is to say you have to stand for the anthem or stay in the locker room or otherwise you're fined, and the Eagles are disinvited from the White House, where they weren't going anyway. It's not that we haven't come forward or that things haven't changed, but so much of the push and pull feels very familiar.
It does. I think the tension in the book, to me, has always been black body over black brain. This tension in of itself is, in a lot of ways, the book. Because the reason why we still look to these athletes is because the black brain is not being respected and being exploited and being encouraged nearly as much as the black body. We still look to these athletes, and we still look to these entertainers, and we still look to these singers and everyone, even at a time when this entire notion of a heritage and this entire notion of athletics was supposed to open the door to education and to open the door to these other pursuits. So you didn't have to look at a Jackie Robinson as your leader. You could look at a doctor, a lawyer, a senator, the same way you do with other races. You know, at a time when you're looking at these athletes who are making incredible amounts of money, more than they've ever have, but at the same time, they're coming out of college less and less and less educated. So that tension leaves you with the player still. We still look to LeBron James to be the peacemaker, and we look to Dwayne Wade, and we look to these players to sort of now, because they're so tied in with these mega corporations, we look to them to sort of be the bridge between black and white, which is very different from the Muhammad Ali days where they were straight advocates for African Americans. So at the same time, when you have shut up and dribble, you have the player prominence is becoming greater and greater and greater, and you just wonder if that time is going to come when the player recedes and then the intellectual, the black intellectual, can take over where I think they always should have been in the first place.
Well, let me ask you what kind of reaction you're getting. I think you're pretty early in taking this book around, but what kind of reaction do you expect to get, and what sorts of conversations are you looking to spur here?
The reaction that I get has been very similar to the reactions that I always tend to get when I do these projects. One is there's the immediate shouting, oh, well, you're attacking the police, and oh, this is going to be controversial, and oh, you're never going to work again, and you know, no one's going to take an interest in this. That's always the initial reaction. And then the book comes out, and then people start reading, and then we start discussing. We start discussing how we feel about patriotism. We start discussing the president essentially trying to deny citizenship of Americans for protesting. We discuss how we feel about our civil liberties being attacked or being essentially turning sporting events into nationalistic pep rallies. And now all of a sudden you get a different response. And that response is you've got good thinking citizens of all stripes, and they're saying it's about time. It's about time we actually talk about this. And so that's always been the rewarding thing. And I think to me the conversations that I always try to spur when I do any project is to think about who we are and to think about where we are in this country and to always consider the accountability factor of the people who are pulling the strings here, the power of the corporation, whether it's a sports league or whether it's the military and the Department of Defense, that the power that these institutions have are steering us in ways and we're not even paying attention. The one thing, Janine, that I've been fascinated and somewhat disappointed about, but also encouraged because maybe we can think about these things more, is the number of people, almost 20 years post 9/11, who devour sports and see the flag at the 50-yard line and they see the law enforcement appreciation days and they know the paid patriotism story that this was a deception. But then when it all gets put together, they say, I never thought of it that way. So hopefully we'll do a little bit more thinking and we'll see what some of these institutions are doing to us and how they're trying to manipulate us.
We've been speaking with Howard Bryant. The new book is The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. It's out now from Beacon Press. Howard Bryant, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
A very thin layer between the sea surface and the atmosphere may be a major factor in how hot we get and how fast. Since the ocean absorbs at least a quarter of all our greenhouse gas emissions, it's a big deal how the sea surface microlayer operates now and in the future. We have news based on hard measurements from a team of scientists in Great Britain. The lead author joins us to explain. Dr. Ryan Pereira is a research fellow at the Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. From low river air in the Amazon to the weird spot where the ocean and atmosphere mix, Ryan peers into microbiology and geochemistry of places that are barely visible to the human eye. His latest paper was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on May 28, 2018. From Edinburgh, Ryan Pereira, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks very much.
Well, look, it's good to talk with you, and at first glance, I have to admit, the whole subject of your paper seemed a little fuzzy to me, and then I realized that's because you're exploring places that are really unknown to most of us. For the layperson, what is the sea surface microlayer, or SML?
Sure. So the sea surface microlayer is the skin of any water surface. So in this case, we're talking about the ocean. If you wanted to give an exact depth, it's something around 400 microns in thickness. A way that I often explain it to, as you say, lay people or the neighbor next door, is that it's like the meniscus on your drink or some kind of cocktail. So it's a very, very thin layer.
A meniscus, did you say?
A meniscus, absolutely.
I don't know that word. What's that?
So if you have a glass of water and you hold it up to the light and you look through the glass, you'll see that the water surface itself has got two lines to it, okay, the top and the bottom, and that is the water layer, and that's known as a meniscus.
Great. Okay, now this surface microlayer must be heaved up and down by waves and tides or drawn around by currents and winds. Does the microlayer maintain itself as constant and everywhere in the ocean?
Okay, so the surface microlayer is physically and chemically distinct from its underlying waters. That's something else that I should have said. And so it does vary in space and time as a function of turbulence. So, for example, wind and waves. So either that's airside turbulence or waterside turbulence. And then as a function of supply of various substances from the underlying water to the surface as they rise up.
According to your studies, key particles within the sea surface microlayer can reduce the amount of carbon the ocean can absorb, and that could increase the amount of carbon dioxide left in the atmosphere and so warm the planet. But to understand, we have to talk about something called surfactants. I thought I knew what they were, but I didn't know what they are in the ocean. What is a surfactant?
Well, a surfactant is a shortened word for surface active substances. What are surface active substances? Well, they are something that is lipophilic and hydrophilic, so water and fat loving, okay? And these molecules, they can stand end on end and form surface slicks in the ocean, but they can also dampen waves on the ocean. And they can be man-made or they can be naturally produced. So naturally produced surfactants could be things such as exudates from phytoplankton within the ocean. You can actually even produce them off the skin of your hands, or they can be produced by man. So soaps, for example, are a natural surfactant, or sorry, an anthropogenic surfactant that are used obviously in day-to-day, so things like detergents and so on.
Yes, in detergents. I think that's where I first heard about surfactants. They're in advertising or on the packages of detergents. But these ones that we're talking about, though, come from phytoplankton, but they're not phytoplankton. They come from it. What's that about?
Okay, so a lot of that work still needs to be determined. I mean, there's a lot of literature about biologically produced surfactants and where they can come from. I think ultimately we are attributing the surfactants that we have observed to biological surfactants because of the where we have found them in the ocean themselves. So the influence of man-made surfactants is highly unlikely. And we would, we talk about primary producers here in phytoplankton. So really we talk about algal substances or algal communities, shall we say.
And why do surfactants matter when it comes to the ocean as a carbon sink?
So with respect to the gas exchanges that we've been discussing here, when surfactants go to the surface ocean, they can either act as a physical barrier, thereby reducing the rate of exchange or the speed at which gases can travel across that surface microlayer or the ocean film that we discussed earlier, or they can actually dampen capillary waves. So these are waves that are on the ocean surface, and they actually reduce the surface area that allows for gas exchanges. So therefore, you reduce the amount of gas that can travel over one particular area.
And before your new study, Ryan, what did climate scientists assume about the ocean's capacity to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere?
What do you mean by that question?
Well, your study has changed something about the way climate scientists make assumptions about the ocean's ability to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, true?
Sure. So what you can't measure gas transfer easily in the fields, because obviously we talked about turbulence, waves, it varies in space and time. And so we typically have to parameterize or the rate of exchange for a given location, and we do that using wind speed typically. Okay, and wind speed is something that is fairly well modeled or measured across the globe for various locations. However, there is an uncertainty in the gas transfer velocities, or the speed at which gas can transfer from the atmosphere to the ocean or vice versa, and wind speed. Okay, and this scatter creates an uncertainty. Okay, and so what we have tried to ascertain is what is this uncertainty and why does this uncertainty exist? And to do that, we've looked at other secondary factors. This could include bubble formation, but we have specifically looked at surfactants and the surface microlayer.
Right, and you did some earlier work on the wind effect in 2017. You co-authored a paper there. And what did you find that was a contribution to science in that paper?
Okay, so that was actually a prelude to this work here in the Atlantic Ocean, in that we were assessing the role of surfactants in the microlayer in coastal systems. And so we did a fairly similar approach where we were taking surfactant measurements from the surface water and the underlying water, and also gas exchange measurements. But we were doing them in space and time. So we had a transect that went out from the northeast of the UK, 20 kilometers out into the North Sea, so that we had a salinity gradient. And we then repeated that transect through time to look at seasonal effects, so winter and summer. Okay, and what we found was that there was a summer-winter difference where we were seeing greater suppressions in the summer, potentially associated with autochthonous or surfactants that are produced within the ocean itself. And then in the winter, we found that the greatest suppressions were near the coast, and that was related to supply surfactants potentially coming from rivers.
Well, let's get to how you know what you know. You took an important ocean cruise in 2014. Tell us about the ship and the mission.
Okay, so the ship was the James Clark Ross, the research vessel James Clark Ross, which is part of the British Antarctic Survey's fleet that they use to support the British Antarctic Survey effort down in Antarctica. And I was fortunate enough to join the Atlantic Meridional Transect, which is a program that runs every year and has run for about 27 years, I think, now, where the ship during the transport or the voyage down to Antarctica is made available for science, where you can stop twice a day, throw a cast or what we call a CTD, a conductivity, temperature, and depth probe that allows us to collect samples. And we did that twice a day, so during midday and in midnight, and we would collect samples so that we would then establish a transect of various geochemical or biological parameters going from the UK down to the Falkland Islands.
And climate scientists have used formulas, from what I understand, largely dependent on measurements of chlorophyll taken by satellites in space. But your team on this trip used some sort of tank to take direct measurements from the Atlantic, from the UK all the way to the Falkland Islands. What is that gas exchange tank?
Well, there are a couple of elements to this. So first of all, you mentioned about remote measurements and then point measurements. And I think it's very important to remember that remotely sensed technology such as chlorophyll A, which is done via satellites, is a great way of spatially upscaling and giving a broad-scale picture, but that needs to be calibrated to point-scale measurements. And the first point is that the surfactant measurements that we were making as a direct measurement on the voyage as well didn't correlate to any of those remotely sensed measurements that we expected would happen. And so this is why we talked about this invisible layer that's infecting the gas exchanges. With regard to your second point, which was about the gas exchange tank itself, what is it? Well, I affectionately call it my fish tank. It's about that sort of size. It's 180 liters, and we would fill it half full, so about 90 liters of water, and then we would add a tracer gas that we would use for measuring the gas transfer velocities, or estimating the gas transfer velocities by measuring the concentration of gas in the water and in the atmosphere over a period of time within this tank. So essentially what we are looking or doing is measuring gas in the water and in the atmosphere over a period of about 3 hours to see how they exchange. And because it's supercharged, the gas concentration is supercharged in the water, what we should see is gas concentrations going down in the water over time, but increasing in the atmosphere or the headspace over time. And we're then able to estimate a flux estimate for that.
Did this new paper come from measurements taken on that 2014 voyage? And if so, why did it take 4 more years to publish it?
You know, you're not the first person to ask me that question. The data did indeed come from the 2014 mission. I think, first of all, it's important to note that cruise scheduling and cruise effort takes an awful long time. So, of course, we didn't actually get our equipment back until 2015. So although the voyage happened in September and October 2014, we didn't get all of the equipment, the data back till 2015. Now, of course, we made the tank measurements and looked at the data very, very quickly within 2015 itself. But it's not just about making measurements. It's about establishing a framework to actually understand and contextualize your data. So an awful lot of the work that we did was actually to be able to upscale and really interpret our data for the entire Atlantic Ocean, not just for September and October when we went out on the cruise, but actually to think about the entirety of 2014. So is there a way that we can upscale our point scale measurements for space and time? And that's really what took the extra amount of time, so from 2015 to 18.
Radio EcoShock. If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Ryan Pereira, a researcher from Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh. We're talking in a general way about whether the ocean can continue to absorb our carbon dioxide pollution or the rate that it does. And we talked earlier, Ryan, about the relationship of wind and carbon uptake. Do we have a universal formula that works in every ocean?
Okay, so there are parameterizations that exist for a given wind speed. And you remember earlier that I mentioned that for various wind speeds, we can estimate the gas transfer velocity. And those parameterizations are applied. But the biological aspect that we have brought in hasn't yet been considered. And so further work really needs to go to address how surfactants vary in spaces and time so that we can then start to apply that in different ocean basins, for example, or coastal systems.
Your study looks at the main driver of global warming, carbon dioxide, but does this new look at carbon uptake by the ocean tell us more about methane as well?
It could do. So the reason that we focused on CO2 is that basically we are restricted by the global database. So when we actually measure gas transfer velocities in our gas exchange tank, we actually use methane as our tracer gas. And then we convert using various scaling factors known as a Schmidt number to scale for various gases based on solubility and diffusivity. And so that's how we were able to determine a gas exchange coefficient for CO2. Now, the reason that our paper focused on CO2 is literally the database of PCO2 measurements in the ocean and then, of course, the atmosphere, and we're able to scale for that again over the period of 2014, which was when our study was done, and for the different zones within the Atlantic Ocean that we're focusing on. It would entirely be possible to look at methane for exactly in exactly the same way, but we don't have the scale of measurements for methane across the Atlantic Ocean to do that.
Why is the surfactant suppression effect greater in the northern hemisphere than in the southern Atlantic? And does it matter that most of the carbon dioxide that could be transferred to the ocean is mainly coming from the northern hemisphere as well?
That's a really good question. Why is that the case? Well, okay, we already know that it's due to the amount of surfactants that are present, and that's most likely as a function of primary productivity. I think we can also say that there may be some forcing there as a result of sea surface temperatures as well, and that's where these warmer waters are. I think with respect to moving forward, I think we I think it is difficult to assess because we just don't really have a wide understanding of the variability of surfactants in the ocean and all of their sources.
Right. And you also talk about hotspots of CO2 exchange in the Atlantic Ocean. Do these matter sort of on a global scale?
Yes. I mean, hotspots of gas exchange, of course, are important because it's not uniform across the Atlantic Ocean. I think these hotspots really are just the first eye-opener as where we perhaps need to focus some of our effort on where we should go back to take further gas exchange measurements and also surfactant measurements to further constrain our work. You know, these hotspots that we've identified are estimates, and I think it would be a first look, and I think we really now need to go to where these hotspots are and do, you know, a primary calibration to make sure that what our estimates are saying are actually true.
We've had experts on phytoplankton on Radio EcoShock, including Sergei Petrovsky, but no one seems sure whether plankton will increase or decrease as the globe warms. What does your study assume, and could that be a further factor in how surfactants in the sea affect the future climate?
So our work showed that with increasing sea surface temperatures, we saw increased surfactants. And so there is a natural feedback loop in the cycle and the carbon cycle here. I think, you know, as you've already indicated, there are experts in phytoplankton and phytoplankton production, and I am certainly not one of those experts, but I think I would predict, or we would hypothesize, that with the increasing temperatures that we would observe, we would expect to see more surfactants as a result of increasing phytoplankton presence or productivity. But of course, I would also expect that there would be some kind of threshold or tipping point where that relationship would no longer hold true as a function of temperature. But when, what threshold value that actually is, that's unknown at present.
So your study, Ryan Pereira, was based on hard data from the Atlantic Ocean. Does it apply equally well to the larger Pacific, or do we have to ship you off to some Pacific islands?
I think you need to ship me off to some Pacific islands, particularly on a good weather day, if that's all right. One with nice beaches are also fully appreciated. No, I mean, in all seriousness, we focused on the Atlantic Ocean because that's where we have primary data from. And, you know, holding my hands up here as a scientist, we had 13 data points that we upscaled from. Of course, we need, and I hate to use the traditional scientific analogy or scientist analogy, but we do really need more data to, you know, look at the seasonal cycle, you know, capturing primary data from, say, the months of January, February, and October, November, where we've seen peak hotspots of activity. And then really we also need to think about how different oceans also behave differently and the circulation patterns associated with that. So, you know, measurements do need to be made in the Pacific Ocean or the Indian Ocean, which really do function completely differently to the Atlantic.
And the abstract for your new paper begins, quote, ocean CO2 uptake accounts for 20% to 40% of the post-industrial sink for anthropogenic CO2. 20% to 40% is a really big range. It makes a very big difference whether 40% of industrial emissions are being absorbed by the ocean or just 20%. Why hasn't this been nailed down much closer than that so far?
Very good question. So that particular statement comes from a reference, and I'm trying to think which reference that comes from at the moment, and I can't answer your question there.
Cunliffe?
Yes, it may well be. Why is the range so high? Very good question. I think, first of all, it's because there's such a variability in the various sinks, and that it also changes in, I keep on saying it, but in space and time. So we already know that the ocean absorbs CO2 at different periods of time because of turbulent settings or turbulence variance, shall we say.
And in part, your paper is kind of a warning to other climate modelers about a weakness of big picture data versus what you actually found taking samples from a ship. What do modelers need to know and to change?
Oh, gosh, what do modelers need to know and change? That's a difficult question. I mean, I am not a modeler. I try to further understand key processes, or at least what I consider to be key processes, with empirical data. I think what the general message of this paper is that we need to make sure that we fully understand not just primary variables, but where we see uncertainty, that we can really look at the, you know, key secondary or tertiary variables that are causing, you know, factors of uncertainty that are likely to propagate out in models when we start to consider upscaling or modeling future scenarios.
And although this is a study of the Atlantic Ocean, Ryan, your paper in Nature Geoscience does consider, quote, global implications of surfactant suppression effect. So do you have any suggestions on what this new study may add to our predictions about the future climate?
Well, gosh, that's, a big question. I think what we've demonstrated is that we know that there are hotspots of CO2 exchange, and we need to better constrain where those hotspots are and also when do they exist, because we know that they can move over time, is particularly seasonally. And also what we don't know is how that changes interannually. You know, are different years going to operate differently? So this data is only from 2014, and we really don't know what it was like in 2015, 16, 17, or even this year. Sorry, repeat your question.
Well, I'm just asking about what this means for the future climate, because we found here something that can suppress the ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide, and we need that function very badly. And your paper seems to narrow down how that all operates.
See, this is a really difficult question. I mean, yes, we know that the surfactant suppression effect could reduce or does reduce the Atlantic Ocean store by 9%. I think the challenge is that this process has already been happening, but if we're trying to model in the future, then we need, this is actually a really tricky question, like, you know, what is the global implication of our work, right? I mean, that's
exactly
where you're heading with this. How do we want to take this forward? I think what we're suggesting here is that we know that because of this relationship between sea surface temperatures and the presence of surfactants, that a warmer climate, which would be part of this positive feedback, would lead to further suppression. But of course, that will also have a threshold in itself, because increasing CO2 in the atmosphere would create an increased concentrational gradient between the atmosphere and the ocean. But we really haven't been able to constrain those rates, and we really aren't able to predict that in an accurate way, or at least not to my knowledge.
So, Ryan, you've studied optically invisible dissolved organic matter in the Amazon, and now bits that we think come from plankton and a hair-thin layer of the ocean. It must be hard to discuss your work at Social Functions. How and why did you get involved in this line of research?
We observed a relationship that didn't make any sense. I think that's how we got into this idea of invisible organic matter. How, at tea parties, and I'll come back to that in a second, how I explain my research is that if we take a cup of tea, and let's imagine it's in a glass so that we can see it, and you take your hot water and you add your tea bag, you have got colored dissolved organic matter in there, okay? And you can see it because it's brown in color. If I then add sugar to that tea, it dissolves, okay, but you can't see it because it's invisible, right? But if you started to taste your tea, you would know that it's been sweetened, okay? And that's what we call invisible dissolved organic matter in this case, or invisible carbon. And that's how I explain it to say, my parents or to those that aren't scientists. And the reason that we became interested in this invisible organic carbon was that when we were in the Amazon looking at these organics, we found that techniques that we were looking to quantify carbon during rain events weren't working. They weren't correlating to the total organic carbon that we were measuring via a more robust laboratory method. And so we started to ask the question, well, why is that relationship falling apart? And essentially we found that some types of organic carbon were actually UV optically invisible to various techniques that we use to measure total organic carbon. So this was in the Amazon using various probes, and it's been also upscaled in satellites. So in this particular context, when we come back to the story in the Atlantic, what we found was that the colored dissolved organic matter measurements made from satellites at the same time were not, or the abundance of this measurement wasn't relating to the abundance of surfactants that we were measuring, which is giving us some kind of indication that these surfactants are actually optically invisible to the satellite measurements.
Fair enough. And as we wrap up here, Ryan, what are you working on now and what are the tasks ahead as you see them?
What are we working on now? I think there's a couple of parts. One is that we really want to try and understand, building on the theme earlier, is, you know, how do surfactants relate to the overall carbon pool? So how are they being sourced? When are they being sourced? And when are they being cycled up to the surface microlayer? And how does that vary in space and time? We talked about other ocean settings, but also coastal settings. And what is the varying effect on gas suppression? We already have done some preliminary work that demonstrates that different types of organic substances or surfactants will actually vary the gas exchange. So the composition type seems to be important for the amount of gas exchange. And so this is the next step for us, looking at the composition of organics, how they change, and the variable rate of gas exchange.
The new paper we've been talking about is titled Reduced Air-Sea CO2 Exchange in the Atlantic Ocean Due to Biological Surfactants. It was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on May 28th. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Ryan Pereira, from Harriet Watt University in Scotland. I'll put notes and links to all this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Ryan, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I've learned quite a bit from you today.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Why are you here?
I'm here because climate change is probably the most important issue of our time, and if we don't do something about it in the next 10 years, it might be too late. And so it's about Canadians overwhelmingly want our federal and provincial governments to take action on global warming. And unfortunately, in most cases, they're dragging their heels. And so today's it's a celebration, but it's also a call to action and telling our federal government to be a leader on climate change instead of a laggard. It's embarrassing when other countries are miles ahead of us and Canada is just dragging its heels. And so today's saying, you know what? Let's do something, and let's do it in the right way. Let's reclaim the green mantle that Canada used to have at one time.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now that climate change has melted the Arctic sea ice for part of the year at least, Russia is scrambling to grab any new oil, gas, or coal that suddenly becomes available along their northern shore. That way, just so you understand, climate change helps humans make climate change worse. But that is not the bottom of crazy. You haven't heard outright madness until you hear this story from Jan Haverkamp. Jan is a trained scientist and a specialist in nuclear energy and radiation. He works for Greenpeace in Central Europe. Jan co-founded the Brussels-based NGO Nuclear Transparency Watch. Haverkamp teaches environmental communication at Masaryk University in the Czech Republic. For years, Jan lived and worked from Prague, but now he's back in the Netherlands. From Amsterdam, Jan Haverkamp, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jan, if we were looking at the big barge called the Academic Lomonosov, what would we see?
You see a 144-meter-long brown-black block with a central block on top of it. 144 meters is quite long. I've seen it in the Baltic Sea with on the background a few container ships. Then it's not that big. It's 30 meters wide. It's about 28 meters high. In the central part, this extra block on top, there is the place where two icebreaker reactors are situated. It didn't look very pleasant. It looks quite ugly, but the artist's impressions are a lot better. It's supposed that it's still going to be painted over. The artist's impressions have made it very beautifully white and blue. So far, it looks really also not only ugly from the inside, but also ugly from the outside.
And before we dig deeper into this story, Jan, what makes this nuclear barge stand out among all the other crazy news these days?
This is the first purpose-built nuclear power station that is situated on a barge. We've had one earlier, which was the U.S. Sturgis, an old Liberty ship from the Second World War, which was equipped with a submarine reactor and provided power for the Panama Canal Zone for 7 years until they retracted it from there because it was running relatively often into trouble. That one has only been decommissioned or is in decommissioning at the moment, and the reactor was only removed last year. You can already see a little bit how complex it is to deal with something like a floating nuclear power station. The operation in the Panama Canal Zone was in the 1960s, and decommissioning was only now.
The Russians and the Soviet government before them put nuclear reactors in everything from icebreakers to submarines. What is their safety record?
That is not so good. We've had accidents during construction, during maintenance. We've had accidents on full sea, and those include also several where there have been meltdowns, so fuel meltdowns, during a testing problem in Nizhny Novgorod, what is now Nizhny Novgorod and was still Gorky in the Soviet times. 29 people died. We've had several dozens of severe incidents, and several of these reactors are also still on the bottom of the sea because of the accidents that the submarines that were carrying them were submitted to.
Why did people in St. Petersburg protest operations building that barge, Academic Lomonosov?
Well, that was already last year. The initial start of the construction was not in St. Petersburg, but because of all kinds of internal trouble between different involved oligarchs, construction was moved to the Baltic shipyards in St. Petersburg. And that shipyard is situated very centrally. It is on 2.5 kilometers from the St. Isaac Cathedral, about 3 kilometers, 3 and a bit from the Hermitage. So it's bang in the center of St. Petersburg. And the idea was originally that when the construction was finalized, that the fuel would be loaded in the Baltic shipyard and that the barge would be tested there. Now, the testing phase is one of the more risky parts of the lifetime of a reactor, and people in St. Petersburg were not really very happy with it. There was a petition which drew 12,000 signatures, which for any petition in Russia which is critical on something that is done by the authorities is an enormous amount. And questions were asked in the Environmental Committee of the Legislative Council of the city, which then basically asked the authorities to not to load and test the reactor in the city, in the midst of a city with 5 million inhabitants. There was also a lot of pressure on this from the countries along the Baltic Sea, not as much because of the testing in St. Petersburg, but also at the moment that the reactors are tested, they're irradiated, which means that the radioactive contact is a lot higher than when there's no fuel on board. And they were very much afraid that when it would be transported, towed, because it does not have its own propulsion, so it would be towed through the Baltic Sea and along the Norwegian coast, in case of heavy storm and the thing running on the rocks, it might really be also an radiation risk for their shore. So they put up quite a lot of diplomatic pressure on Russia as well. And the result was that last year, Rosatom decided not to load and not to test it in St. Petersburg, but tow it empty to Murmansk. And that is where it has now arrived 2 weeks ago and where it is to be loaded in the coming months and then tested.
And can you just briefly tell us, our listeners, where Murmansk is?
Well, St. Petersburg, as you may know, is on the Baltic Sea coast. So you have it's very near Finland and Estonia in the northern part of the Baltic Sea. Murmansk is in the northwest of Russia. It is not so far from where Norway touches Russia and where Finland touches Russia.
So it's up in the Arctic Sea, really?
It is already in the Arctic Sea, yes.
Okay. Now, you have said previously that the design of this barge as a floating platform for reactors is not safe. Could you tell us why?
Well, it is. First of all, if you build a nuclear power plant on a floating structure, you have to be quite weight conscious. That means that a lot of the very heavy end-of-pipe solutions that we put on nuclear power stations to prevent at any time radioactivity coming out, a lot of those kind of very heavy measures cannot be taken on a barge. On top of that, the space is very limited, and that means also that you are cutting corners with the type of safety measures that you can implement. That means that the risk of something going wrong is just higher than when we compare that with a land-based nuclear power station of the last generation. That is one part. The other part is it's on a barge. And when that barge comes loose, it could either be thrown on the rocks in a storm, or during transport, it could also run onto ice. And the hull could be torn open, like for instance, happened with the unsinkable Titanic. That also adds to the extra risk. There are two issues that add to extra risk, and for that reason, environmental organizations like Greenpeace, but also like Bellona and others, are very critical about the introduction of floating reactors, be it on barges or in submarines or on icebreakers, into a pretty hostile environment as the Arctic.
Is there a significant storm risk for the waters where this barge is intended to go, and where is it intended to go?
Well, it is intended to go to Pevek, and Pevek is in Chukotka, which is the furthest northeastern province of Russia, the one that is also nearest to Alaska. Pevek itself is still about 1,000 kilometers further to the west, so it's not that near to Alaska. From Murmansk to Pevek, the voyage is almost 5,000 kilometers, or about 3,500 miles. That's a very long stretch, and it's an area that can see very heavy weather. That includes heavy storms, but it also includes unpredictable ice activity there, so icebergs or other floating ice in the region.
From what I can see, Jan, all the Russian nuclear reactors and new atomic constructions are run by a state-owned company called an English Rosenergoatom, or sometimes Rosatom. Is that correct?
Well, the Rosatom group is, let's say, the center of this enormous conglomerate, which used to be the state ministry for nuclear energy in the Soviet times. After Soviet times, it was made into a separate corporate entity called Rosatom, and that has several hundreds of sub-units and companies under it. Yes, it's Rosatom that is responsible not only for all the civil nuclear power in Russia, but also for all the military nuclear power in Russia. They also build and oversee, for instance, the nuclear weapon part of the Russian nuclear system.
The Russian state-owned company is promoting this barge project with quotes from an Australian convert to nuclear power, Dr. Ben Hurd. Ben is the executive director of the NGO Bright New World. The Russian nuclear company Rosatom quotes Ben Hurd in their propaganda, I would call it, but in their promotion for this project. And they have been saying this: "It's fair to point out that the Arctic is a vulnerable ecosystem, but its greatest vulnerability is to climate change. This power plant is going to replace an existing coal-fired power station and provide zero carbon electricity generation for 50,000 people. There is literally no prospect of that energy coming from renewable energy sources in that location." Jan Haverkamp, what is your response?
Well, first of all, I mean, Pevek itself at the moment has 5,000 inhabitants, and the coal power station that Ben is referring to is the thermal or the heat, the generation plant that provides Pevek also with heat. That's a minor plant. What it also has to provide electricity for is some of the remaining mining activity in that area, and that includes, amongst others, also coal mining. So that is one part of the equation. It's not only going to replace an old coal power plant, it's also going to enable more coal mining, which means also more coal burning. But I think that is all slightly besides the point when Ben is claiming that it's impossible or that it's not likely that renewable energy will be introduced there. Then that is a conscious political choice. Rosatom is pretty new, is also working on renewable energy, but is still pretty new in it. They're now making their first experiences with wind energy together with a Dutch company called Lagerwey. but the potential for renewable energy in the area is enormous. And a small town like Pevek and the surroundings could easily be powered with a combination of wind power and, for instance, sustainably harvested biomass from the surroundings. That is as such not a problem. What is for us the larger concern is that this is going to be the first of a whole series of floating nuclear power stations, and that has to power the further development of the entire north, including Pevek. And that development is development for more oil, gas, and coal extraction. So for me, this is a bit of a double whammy. It is introducing nuclear risk in an area where nuclear risk is a larger problem than, for instance, in more moderate places like Fukushima or Belgium or in the United States. That is the first point. The second point is it is meant to increase extraction of fossil fuels. So for me, that is clear enough that that then is used here for propaganda.
And it worries me that a supposed green voice in Australia is being used by Russian state propaganda for their nuclear adventures.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the world's largest environment program on nonprofit radio. Our guest is nuclear campaigner and scientist Jan Haverkamp. We're talking about a dangerous new development by Russia, floating barges with nuclear reactors off to the Arctic. Many scientists on Radio EcoShock have explained why the Arctic is uniquely vulnerable to pollution. What happens when this atomic barge has a major nuclear accident or just sinks in a storm? And do the Russians explain any plan that they have for that?
There are no real plans for emergency response in these kind of cases. We've seen it in the past with the Kursk nuclear submarine. The attempts to have the reactors from that and also, of course, the people who were on board, but the reactors from that salvaged have cost several billions of dollars. So it's not very easy to do something when something goes wrong. But I think your listeners will be aware of the fact that with any nuclear power stations, we have severe problems with emergency response and preparedness. The more challenging the environment is, the more challenging also post-accident reactions are. Yeah, in this case, Rosatom is characterized very much is there are now not very many people living there. So the personal damage may be, because of that, lower. Of course, these reactors are smaller, and you do have to acknowledge that it's not as big as the reactors that went wrong in Fukushima or in Chernobyl. But still, for the people involved, that will be a very big catastrophe in their lives.
What are the issues with refueling these reactors, and what happens to the highly radioactive spent fuel?
The reactors have a fueling cycle of about 2.5 years. The Lomonosov will be towed to Pevek, will stay there for 12 years. So that means that we will have about 4 or 5 fuel cycles there. That means that it has all its fuel, its fresh fuel aboard. And at the moment that a cycle needs to be changed, there will be fuel change from the reactor. The spent fuel will be remaining on board, will be stored on board.
On Radio EcoShock, Dr. Helen Caldicott told us that all nuclear reactors create plutonium, and not just a little plutonium. Would this barge, Academic Lomonosov, have plutonium and other super radioactive fission products on it as well?
Well, the spent nuclear fuel from these reactors is like spent nuclear fuel from any boiling water reactor, so it indeed contains plutonium and other actinides. That spent nuclear fuel is extremely radioactive, and one of the design problems that we already know that the Lomonosov has is that after about 4 or 5 fuel changes, the radioactivity level from the storage of the spent fuel is so high that it will limit the amount of time that the crew can spend on board. They are planning to change that in new designs, but this design has that just as a problem, and it's one of the reasons that already after 12 years it will need to go back to Murmansk for unloading that spent fuel and for maintenance.
Britain used to dump radioactive barrels straight into the ocean until Greenpeace protests helped stop that. There are a number of reactors, I think it's 9, now sitting at the bottom of the sea, including the American submarine USS Scorpion. And the Japanese are now threatening to dump atomic pollution from blown reactors at Fukushima. Here's my question to you, Jan, as an environmental scientist. Have there been studies on how nuclear particles move around in the ocean?
Well, there are quite a few older studies to the spread of several things. I mean, it's first of all the spread of the fallout of nuclear weapons, how that has been spreading through the oceans. We also have seen assessments of what the dumping of radioactive waste by the UK, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, and Belgium, and Germany in the Atlantic, just south of the United Kingdom, has resulted in. Fission products from that, so isotopes from that dumping, and that was low and mid-level radioactive waste, has been found on both poles, so as we found both in the Arctic as also in the Antarctic, which means that it spreads out very far. That is an advantage. It means dilution. But the other side is, and that we've also seen, especially around these dumping areas, is that part of the waste is also bioaccumulating in the direct surroundings, which means that we have seen there catch of fish, which has been accumulating radioactive particles, isotopes, especially those that are fatty soluble. We know from around Fukushima that the pattern which fish is polluted and not is quite at random, and fishery there still is quite strictly monitored now 6 years after, because every now and then there is fish found which is over limits.
You know that Russia hopes to market these floating reactors to other countries. Who do they hope to sell to?
At the moment, they themselves claim that 15 countries have shown interest. I know for sure that some of that initial shown interest or claimed interest was not really there, like for instance Cabo Verde, the Cape Verde Islands in the Atlantic. They've had one visit once from Rosatom, which was then flagged and promoted as interest in this, but everybody there said, well, this is a crazy idea, we don't want it. But in the countries that are currently under discussion, we have countries like the Philippines, we have Indonesia, and we have Sudan.
Let's say Russia sells a floating reactor to Indonesia. Jan, do the Russians operate and control that reactor, or is there a chance for nuclear proliferation here?
That is difficult to say at this moment, because these talks and ideas are still in a very, very early stage. We know that currently with normal reactors, Rosatom, I mean, you know that the international reactor market is in big trouble because nuclear power has simply become too expensive to market. And financing is the big bottleneck for new programs. And Rosatom has solved it so far by offering countries not only to build reactors, but also to give them either a loan for the full or 90% or 80% of the construction cost, or the option that Rosatom itself will own the reactor and run it and only sell the electricity, like, for instance, in Turkey. I have no idea what in the end the idea will be for floating reactors, but most likely will be that it will be a lease option, so that the country will rent the reactor from Rosatom and pay for that a certain amount of money, and then can use the electricity from it. The question is then, who is going to operate it? Will that be Rosatom, or will that indeed be the country that is here enhanced? Now, some countries or several countries are looking to nuclear power as a means to obtain nuclear knowledge. And for me, that means that there is a proliferation risk. If I look to a country like Iran, I've got no idea whether they have a bomb. I do know that there are factions within Iran that would like to have a bomb. We even had in Poland, there is a whole discussion going on about Poland building its first nuclear power station. Yes or no, even there we've had voices and factions that said, well, we should get this nuclear knowledge and this nuclear experience so that in 40 or 60 years from now, we would be able to build our own bomb and we would be able to get back V4 or fill news. I mean, there's mad people in every country, and it depends very much on political developments how this knowledge is used. If you spread these kind of floating reactors in their hundreds all around the globe, then that definitely supports proliferation also of nuclear weapon knowledge and probably also of nuclear weapon production.
And there is, sadly, news that both China and Japan are working on floating nuclear reactors. And from my point of view, if we spread floating reactors around the world, we're also creating new targets for terrorism or in a war. Most land-based reactors, as you said, have some protective shell. Are these seagoing reactors hardened against hits by something like a rocket-propelled grenade or even an aircraft flying into them?
You can do a lot with steel, but because you have to be careful with weight, the protection is not as good as we see it on board of a nuclear submarine. It's definitely not as good as you would see it in Generation 3 plus nuclear reactors, which are protected against also the impact of a moderately large passenger airplane. That is not possible in this form. Plus, we have, of course, the problem that if you are able to create a leak in the reactor, that probably also will mean a leak in the barge itself. If it's sinking at the moment, if reactor material hits seawater, you will get a water explosion, and with that most likely also a far faster emission of radioactive substances from the reactor. The sheer amount also of small reactors that are dreamed of would increase also the chance of a potential terrorist attack at a certain moment. All these things add up, and for me that's a reason to say I don't think that this is the way we need to go, apart from the fact that it's also very costly. The Lomonosov is in construction and operation not cheaper than the very large nuclear power stations that are currently built and that currently are far too expensive to operate on the market. So also there, it doesn't really make sense.
Is it safe for Russian journalists to criticize Russians' reactor schemes?
There is quite a bit of critical noise about this scheme, independent Russian media. The only problem is that the independent Russian media have a very small reach nowadays. You do not talk about television, but you talk about some of the printed media and some radio and a lot of on the social media, on the internet. The reach is very limited, and we know from experience that people criticizing these kind of projects also indeed have to count with intimidation. It's one of the reasons that I'm working on this with our Nordic offices and Greenpeace Central Europe, but that the Russian office is not part of our work there.
If you had to list your three upcoming priority issues, Jan Haverkamp, what would they be?
That goes already beyond only floating nuclear power stations. I think if we look at the development of the energy system, we need to stop being diverted by nuclear power as a technology. Nuclear power will not deliver anything substantial, and what it can deliver, it will deliver far too late for playing a role in the whole climate discussion, because it delivers it for such a price that we can do it a lot cheaper with other technologies nowadays. Nuclear is not part of that solution, but it is part of an existing problem. And what I would like to see is that we turn around the discussion with and within the nuclear industry and within authorities and nuclear authorities away from new production, from new reactors towards the legacy that 60 years of nuclear power have left us with. We have no way of dealing with radioactive waste anywhere yet. The projects that are ongoing in Finland and Sweden and France are currently hitting technical obstacles that might well prevent them from ever going into operation. We have no plan B, but we do have 300,000 tons of heavy radioactive, of high-level radioactive waste all around the world. That is, for me, a nightmare. We know already that our generation, your and my generation, will not be able to come with a solution. I know that the generation of my children will not be able to come with a solution. but we do have the responsibility to at least reduce the risks of that as much as we can. And it's not happening at the moment. The third point for me is we need to think a lot more about how we can protect ourselves against potential nuclear emergencies and then also draw conclusions from that. We've seen what the Fukushima catastrophe has done. It made it necessary to evacuate 160,000 people. About 60,000 of them still have not been able and will never be able to return to their houses. That is a scar on the planet. But if I look at other places where we now have running nuclear power stations, also there we cannot really safeguard the people around it if it really goes wrong. And I think that if we are honest about that and if we honestly look at what is in place and what we could expect, we have to draw conclusions for the reactors that are currently in operation and we have to phase them out as soon as possible. We've gotten sufficient examples to show that it can be done. Germany is a point in case. But we also see it now in countries like Sweden, which is going to a nuclear phase out. We see it in Switzerland, Belgium. We have seen it in Taiwan. It is possible to turn that development to one that gives hope to the planet, that tackles climate change in a way that we do not waste money, we do not waste efforts, we're not diverting our attention from what really needs to be done. The technologies are there. It needs political will. And that is where I will be fighting for.
Our guest is nuclear campaigner and scientist Jan Haverkamp. Jan has been warning the world about a dangerous scheme to float nuclear reactors in the seas of the Siberian Arctic. The Russians will use it to exploit still more fossil fuels that endanger our common future. Find links to everything we've talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Jan Haverkamp, thank you for sharing this news on Radio EcoShock.
You're welcome, and I hope that your listeners will help us turn this madness into a bit of a more sensible direction.
From madness to sanity, I'm Alex Smith reporting. By the way, if you tuned in partway or missed a show, you can get all our past programs absolutely free at my website, ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. You don't have to sign up or sign in. Just browse the programs and download to your phone, computer, or whatever you've got. It's possible to get a good education in climate change and the things that shape our future just from those interviews with the world's top experts, authors, and activists. You're welcome. Be sure to tune in next week to Radio EcoShock. We will get the latest update on carbon emissions and the fading hopes of even staying below 2 degrees C this century. I'll be talking with Dr. Pep Canadel, the director of the Global Carbon Project. That is a network of hundreds of scientists, and they have found an unexpected bubble of carbon emissions in the first 3 months of 2018. Don't miss that interview. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
You know, we felt compelled at that point to take to the streets and begin having rallies and protesting outside of their concerts.
I think it is important to keep in mind the degree to which Brand Israel is integrated into our political life here in the United States.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. For months, human rights activists have held demonstrations outside the performance hall of the Philadelphia Orchestra, demanding it cancel its upcoming trip to Israel as part of its world tour. On May 19th, protesters disrupted the orchestra's performance inside the concert hall, while dozens of activists rallied outside. As the orchestra left for Europe and continued to reject demands to cancel the concerts in Israel, the protests followed it. Activists in Brussels, Belgium, interrupted the orchestra during a performance of a Brahms piano concerto on May 24th with chants of Free, Free Palestine. 100 artists, scholars, and dozens of social justice organizations have called on the Philadelphia Orchestra to cancel the Israel trip, due to begin the first week of June. Those protesting the tour have said that while the orchestra claims the trip is not a political mission, officials in Israel's consulate in New York confirmed that the performance is meant to mark 70 years since Israel's founding and the, quote, unilateral declaration of Jerusalem as its capital, according to the Philadelphia Don't Orchestrate Apartheid campaign. Musicologist Philip Gentry wrote in the Philadelphia Inquirer that the trip is, quote, a right-wing fantasy tour of Israel, a glaring absence of women's voices, an artistic vacuum when it comes to contemporary music, all hiding behind a romantic notion of the sanctity of classical music. We're joined by novelist, poet, and activist Susan Abelhawa from Philadelphia. Susan, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Hi, thanks, Nora. Thanks for having me.
So let's begin by having you lay out the significance of these ongoing protests against the orchestra as they ignored 2 months of sustained calls by human rights activists and left their Israel itinerary on their world tour.
So, like you said, we started out giving them the benefit of the doubt, thinking that maybe they just don't know, and perhaps, speaking to them privately would be fruitful. So we went that route, but we did it in a way that was thoughtful and backed up with research and a lot of signatures, as you pointed out. It was over 35 organizations and I think 120 individuals who signed it. And all of them were musicians, artists, writers, and activists, scholars, noteworthy personalities, and we thought, and a lot of them were known personalities in the music world and known personalities in Philadelphia. But the first response we got from them was quite telling. It was a very short email that we found very patronizing, dishonest, and also kind of microaggressive. We renewed our invitation or offer to speak with them, which they just ignored completely. So, we felt compelled at that point to take to the streets and begin, having rallies and protesting outside of their concerts and informing their patrons what's happening and why we were there. And they continued to ignore us. I think they really just kind of dismissed us, as power often does. They were getting over $2 million, it sounds like, from donors through the Jewish Federation. And this tour was completely coordinated with the Israeli government. They like to say they weren't, but based on their own press releases, based on photographs of them with the Israeli consulate vetting this this whole tour, tweets from the Israeli consulate in New York, and also the fact that the Jewish Federation itself is kind of a domestic arm of Israel, and they make no secret of that either. So all of these things put together make it very clear that they knew what they were doing. And but they continue to this day to vehemently deny that, there was any such collaboration, despite, all evidence to the contrary. And things escalated a bit when we published an op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And the op-ed initially was published online and was going to be printed in the Sunday paper. And we found out later through a member, somebody who's on the mailing list of the ADL, that there was actually an effort by the ADL and the Jewish Federation and other Zionist organizations to pressure the Philadelphia Inquirer not to print our op-ed. That failed, but they did succeed in getting a counter, you know, quote unquote balance, whatever. So they ran side by side in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And so it was an op-ed that I wrote and an op-ed that the ADL, Naomi Klein, I guess, from the, I think she's either Jewish Federation or ADL, I can't recall. So those were the two op-eds that ran side by side. And then the next day, there was an op-ed by the president of the orchestra. And then again, the day after that, there was another op-ed, not an op-ed, but an editorial by the Inquirer staff, you know, basically completely demonizing us and extolling the virtues of Israel and the orchestra, et cetera, et cetera. So they immediately went on the attack. But I think that it was, you know, having it in the public sphere like that and combined with our relentless weekly rallies outside of their concerts started to it escalated matters a bit, and they kind of got on the defensive. The Inquirer was also very good about, you know, just writing stories, reports on what's happening, and they gave our protest coverage, and that, you know, that also had an impact. Patrons were, some were very hostile. We were spat upon. We were, at least I think three or four different people tried to, physically take the microphone from us. One man who said that he's a former IDF, person, came, you know, was very kind of came at us very aggressively and snatched a poster out of my hand. So there was some of that. And then, of course, people giving us the finger and, you know, stuff like that and, you know, just cursing at us. But there were also people who were very receptive and wanted to learn more. There was one couple that came out and started chanting with us. Several people walking in said, you know, we're with you. We completely agree with you. And at least one family actually turned around and left, and just, you know, I guess tossed their tickets because, you know, they said, you know, we had no idea and we will never support the orchestra again. And actually that happened in France also. Apparently there were like several people who said that, and some who actually left and some who said they would have never gotten tickets had they known. So, and then on the final day, before they were scheduled to leave, our protest included a disruption inside the hall. A video of that was published, and basically there were two people who had tickets. They were paying patrons. Took a pre-recorded message inside and played it just before the concert started. The recording was amplified with speakers so everyone in the hall could hear it. Initially there were cheers, and then there were like heckling and somebody started the Eagles chant or something. But what's interesting is that, so our person who was inside and recorded this, reported back that, Yannick, the music director and conductor, put his hands over his ears like a child and started saying la 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 la, right? The next day, that part was not reported in the newspaper, but it was reported his like otherwise very petulant behavior on stage, of slamming his baton down and storming off stage. That was reported in the Inquirer. But I had the Philadelphia Magazine, not the Inquirer, called me the next day and wanted to do an interview. And I gave them an interview and I mentioned that bit of, you know, the him vocalizing la 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 with his hands over his ears. And the orchestra kind of, I guess, flipped out about that and said, that's an outrageous accusation, you know, basically calling me a liar. Well, the audio of him vocalizing la 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 was actually picked up in our video. The orchestra vehemently denied that Yannick did that. However, we provided Philadelphia Magazine with, you know, there was obviously the audio, and we gave them initially two eyewitness accounts. And then there was a third eyewitness who actually happened to be my daughter's high school teacher. She wasn't with us. We didn't know she was going to be there. My daughter was with us at the protest on Saturday and she recognized her going in. I didn't see her cause I guess I was somewhere else, but you know, she's an older Quaker, teacher of, religion studies at, you know, at a Quaker high school, who would have no reason to lie. And of course, she confirmed that he did, in fact, put his hands over his ears. So that behavior was confirmed. But nonetheless, the Philadelphia Magazine insisted that they could not confirm. And also, the other denial was that that the orchestra wasn't working with the Israeli government or had not collaborated with them, etc. So, but Philadelphia Magazine refused to, you know, correct their correction.
Yeah, let's talk about how the orchestra responded after that interview in Philadelphia Magazine. They said that they wouldn't be touring an army base, but that, quote, musicians of the orchestra will give master classes to young students and members of the outstanding musicians of the IDF program. You know, essentially repeating this old trope that music or art in any form transcends politics and they're building right. bridges. And at the same time, as you pointed out, the orchestra has been playing, you know, a very clumsy attempt at whack-a-mole, you know, trying to put out various public relations fires as criticisms flare around its relationship with the Israeli government or, you know, yeah. or the Israeli consulate and planned visits to military bases. They also removed any reference to a meeting with Israel's culture minister, Miri Regev, the one who famously called African migrants a cancer on the state of Israel, yeah. and then later apologized to cancer victims for comparing them to Africans. The activism group Adala New York tweeted the other day that instead of tinkering with their itinerary, maybe the orchestra should just cancel this trip. What's your response to these efforts to buck the cultural boycott call and really a PR mess that they have on their hands right now?
So it's like you said, I mean, their response was very clumsy, inconsistent, dishonest, and obviously not well thought out. I think that they didn't realize, they didn't understand the depth of our pain. They didn't realize the you know, how implacable our resolve is. And I think it took them by surprise and it put them on the defensive. So they did, they also, in addition to removing Miri Regev from the itinerary, although that doesn't mean she actually was removed from the itinerary, they just took her name off of the website because there's just no defense for it. Like, how do you do that? Right. So they, after the Philadelphia Magazine interview was published, suddenly and quietly, the VIP tour of the military base, of the IDF base, was removed from the itinerary. And the orchestra, claiming that that's, you know, that they're doing no such thing, is laughable. It's right there on the itinerary. The whole purpose, they're trying to say, well, the patron itinerary is different from the orchestra's itinerary, which is bollocks. You know, patrons are paying over $17,000 per person to take this trip. And part of the appeal is that they will be interacting with the orchestra throughout the trip. So when they go to an IDF base, members of the orchestra are free to go. So it's part of the orchestra's itinerary too. And my understanding is that members of the orchestra are encouraged and expected to be at some of these dinners and things like that. So, so they're just being completely dishonest about that. And then to say, you know, I mean, and also what is, you know, what's the difference between performing with soldiers and then saying, oh, but they're young musicians of the IDF. Like, it's trying to soften the fact that you're literally having a concert with murderers, people who are literally on, you know, surrounding Gaza and shooting at unarmed protesters. You try to soften it by saying young, you know, young soldiers or whatever. Like, they're still soldiers. We're saying the same thing, but just because you say it in a kinder, softer way doesn't change the fact that you are going to perform with a foreign military. You know, what kind of orchestra does that? What kind of orchestra goes and tours a foreign military base? Like, really? It's just, there's no defense of it. It's completely morally indefensible. And the other argument they made at a different time was that, well, this concert has been planned, is being planned for 2 years. And so the world was a different place 2 years ago. So they were trying to say basically that, you know, the murders in Gaza weren't happening. And which is ridiculous, because frankly, the oppression and murder of Palestinians hasn't stopped in 70 years. So they just really, they have, you know, they have, there's no moral defense.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi of the National Iranian American Council, who examines the impact of President Trump's withdrawal from the International Iran Nuclear Agreement on future talks with North Korea and the looming threat of war. Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who assesses the significance of a ceasefire between Afghan government troops and Taliban insurgents, the first since the U.S. invasion 17 years ago. And Mirka Dominguez-Salinas of Make the Road Connecticut and Megan Fountain of Unidad Latina en Acción, who address a rally in Hartford, Connecticut, protesting the Trump administration's policy of separating families seeking asylum in the U.S. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During this spring's massive Great Return March protests along the Gaza-Israeli border, local Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, who spent 22 years in an Israeli prison, fully supported the grassroots resistance to Israel's Gaza blockade. He said the protests, which left 120 dead and 2,700 injured, was a new phase in the Palestinian national struggle on the road to liberation. Over the years, Sinwar, who has deep ties to Hamas's military and intelligence operations, has developed a contradictory reputation as a militant and a realist. Sinwar understands the realities of Middle East politics and the power of the Israeli military. Hamas has repeatedly shown its willingness to negotiate with Israel, such as proposing a truce after a recent missile attack against Israel that in turn triggered Israeli airstrikes against Gaza. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Sinwar is popular in Gaza, where frustration has grown over the densely populated territory's economic blockade and 44% unemployment. In early May, he spoke to Gaza's young people, where many like him are descended from refugees and are bitter about what good the future might hold when their daily lives are so bleak. "We would rather die as martyrs than die out of oppression and humiliation," he told them. "We are ready to die, and tens of thousands will die with us." The European Union is rewriting its laws governing digital data privacy. The EU is now enforcing its new General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which allows internet users to opt out of having their web activity collected by website companies. The act imposes stiff penalties for non-compliance. Since the dawn of the internet age, tech giants such as Google and Facebook have made billions in profits by surveilling and profiling online users in every corner of the internet and delivering big data to advertisers. Privacy advocates say that the EU's new digital privacy law will put a big dent in Google and Facebook's European profits. Under the new law, consumers must consent to having their data collected, stored, and processed. Moreover, tech companies must inform users of a data breach within 72 hours. Penalties for violations of data privacy could run 20 million euros, or 4% of a company's global revenue. Some news reports maintain that Google and Facebook would benefit from GDPR because smaller startup rivals won't be able to pay for the compliance burden. However, many observers hope that GDPR will become a global standard that puts individual privacy ahead of surveillance-based profit. In the shadow of prosperous cities in the Pacific Northwest, scores of highly organized homeless villages have been established to provide a safe, secure environment for homeless people. Contrary to the perception that homelessness generates street crime, such villages help to reduce crime in surrounding neighborhoods. In 5 of 11 homeless villages surveyed by the Guardian newspaper, crime in a broad range of categories decreased in the surrounding neighborhood after they were established. In 4 cases, any change was small, within single digits. In 2 neighborhoods, crime increased. Kenneth Leon, a criminologist at George Washington University, says the Guardian's data is consistent with the position that homeless villages are not generators of crime and could be part of a crime prevention ecosystem. "The numbers show there's no evidence homeless encampments add to crime," wrote Michael Males, senior research fellow at the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice in San Francisco, calling the figures an important finding. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After aggravating tensions with and launching personal attacks against some of America's closest allies over trade issues at the G7 gathering of Western leaders in Quebec, Canada, President Trump arrived in Singapore for his much-anticipated summit meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. While there was hope that the groundbreaking talks between Washington and Pyongyang could pave the way for peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, many observers noted that Trump has demonstrated that he's much more adept at smashing international agreements than building consensus to negotiate new accords. The U.S.-North Korean summit meeting concluded with positive optics, but was very short on substance. In his first year and a half in office, Mr. Trump has broken or disrupted important international treaties or agreements, including his withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement, pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Treaty, and initiated talks to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada. But the president's most consequential decision on international agreements to date was his violation and withdrawal from the International Nuclear Agreement with Iran, which could set off a new nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, vice president of policy with the National Iranian American Council. Here he assesses the impact of Donald Trump's pullout from the Iran nuclear agreement on future talks with North Korea as European nations try to salvage the Iran agreement, obliterated by the U.S., that could lead to war.
I think it's very difficult to for any party to trust that the United States will keep its word on an agreement. And, you know, you had some examples of this already affecting the talks with North Korea. And that's, you know, when John Bolton came out and said that he, you know, they envisioned the Libya model for North Korea, that sort of evoked the memories of Libya giving up its, you know, WMD and capabilities, and then Gaddafi being toppled and the United States supporting his toppling. And so you already have that sort of as a backdrop. With Iran, you actually have a situation where we were in the midst of an agreement that Iran was fully upholding. The latest IAEA, you know, International Inspectors report just came out a couple of days ago and confirms Iran was completely compliant with the nuclear deal. And so I think that this, you know, for any rational actor, this raises serious concerns about how much we can, you know, the U.S. can actually be relied on. Now, an interesting note, Trump has actually said that he, unlike Obama with the Iran deal, he plans to submit an agreement with North Korea to the Senate for ratification. And this is the big criticism of how Obama secured the Iran deal. There was no ratification process. It did go before Congress. Congress had an opportunity to vote it down through this sort of unique mechanism that was passed into law specifically for the Iran deal. But that did not codify the Iran deal into law. It did not codify it as a treaty. And so what opponents of the deal, you know, they criticize it for that. And Trump, being the, you know, the anti-Obama, has even said for this North Korea deal, unlike the Iran deal, which he supposedly is completely justified in backing out of, this is going to be a treaty. And I think that that's going to be a tall order. But it does show the difference in style, at least, where Obama, you know, spent, you know, over nearly 3 years in negotiations with Iran, this very carefully crafted agreement, and sort of needed to navigate the domestic politics, which made it really difficult to strike this deal because there were very powerful U.S. domestic interests lobbying against it, as well as outside, you know, foreign interests lobbying against it. And so he ended up striking the Iran deal, which was pretty far-reaching, but did not necessarily offer as many concessions as perhaps could have been positive to do in order to secure more Iranian concessions. You know, so that the deal was only a nuclear deal. It didn't lift the U.S. embargo, all these things. With Trump, he's sort of, you know, it's more of a bull in a china shop approach, and we'll see sort of how the domestic politics affect this, but also how his decision to kill the Iran deal ends up influencing the party at the other side of the table as far as the willingness to actually sign on to something that may not actually be a deal that lasts into the next presidency.
There are many observers who look at Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran International Nuclear Agreement, along with statements from his national security advisor, John Bolton, and newly named Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, as revealing that the intention here all along might be to pursue war and regime change in Iran. And I'm wondering how likely you think that outcome is, and where does the peace movement in the United States come into play here in terms of that very dangerous and deadly option, if that's indeed what the Trump administration is after?
I really think that similar to, you know, 2002, 2003, in the lead up to Iraq, there was this idea that the United States could have a massive invasion and war on the cheap, and that this was going to be sold as this very clean operation with limited boots on the ground, and we were going to be able to sort of have our cake and eat it too. Today, I think with Iran, the version of that is this notion that the United States is going to sort of help topple the Iranian regime, and that the regime is so close to the brink of collapse that if the United States imposes new sanctions and then potentially does some of the things that John Bolton has talked about, such as supporting ethnic separatist groups inside of Iran, arming terrorists and things like that to try to destabilize the country, and that is somehow a way that the United States can actually take this bad actor off of the map without having to pay too high of a cost. And so I think that the challenge for the peace movement is to really to not wait until it's too late and until we've gone so far down that path that an actual war is inevitable and you have the, you know, you have this administration having sold the American people on this notion that Iran is tied to Al-Qaeda, which is something, you know, propaganda point that Mike Pompeo is a big fan of and which is starting to gain traction once again and is complete nonsense. But I really think for the peace movement, it's going to be a matter of standing up now and calling this stuff out now and not allowing this to get so far down the road that we're unable to actually stop it.
That was Jamal Abdi, Vice President for Policy with the National Iranian American Council. Find links to more news and commentary on Trump's violation of the Iran nuclear agreement and the threat of war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani announced on June 7th that the Afghan army will observe a temporary ceasefire with Taliban insurgents from June 12th through the 19th, coinciding with the end of the holy month of Ramadan during the Muslim holiday known as Eid al-Fitr. Ghani said military operations against other armed groups such as the Islamic State will continue. 2 days later, the Taliban announced that they too would also observe a three-day ceasefire during the holiday. The ceasefire is the first such declared truce since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. The ceasefire was announced just days after a gathering of Afghanistan's top Islamic clerics in the capital of Kabul, where they issued a fatwa, or religious edict, against suicide bombings. However, the religious gathering itself was the target of a suicide bombing that killed at least 7 people. And as the ceasefire got underway on June 12th, Taliban fighters killed a district governor and 8 others in northern Afghanistan. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who recently returned from a trip to Afghanistan. Here she assesses the significance of the recently announced ceasefire, the drought that has stricken 22 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces, and a 400-mile walk for peace recently undertaken by Afghan men.
Well, you know, I'm told that ceasefires are often very, very fragile and hard to sustain. And yet that doesn't mean that it's not a step toward a peace process. So I don't want to sound terribly negative, but I guess, you know, we should just acknowledge that the Taliban have been surrounding Afghan cities like Kunduz in the north or in the western area of Baha, and taking them over for a short time and then withdrawing as a sort of as a sign of their strength. And they have control over roadways leading to cities such that the reality is that the Afghan government is not declaring a ceasefire and therefore they're going to stop offensive attacks. They're really declaring a ceasefire, but they're the ones on the defensive. The Taliban has said, okay, for the 3 days that mark the end of Ramadan, we also will declare a ceasefire. But you see, Ashraf Ghani's and General Nicholson's version of the ceasefire is exclusive to the Taliban. That doesn't mean they'll stop attacking Islamic State in the Khorasan province, ISKP, or you could just consider that Islamic State. There are many, many different warring insurgent groups run by various warlords within Afghanistan. So that makes it all the more difficult to declare a ceasefire, because who's really in on the ceasefire? Certainly the Taliban are the strongest.
What are the prospects for peace, in your view, in terms of negotiations between the Afghan government under Ashraf Ghani and the Taliban?
Well, I don't think that the war can be ended without negotiations. And it's a terrible shame that President Trump has said he won't engage in any negotiations and he doesn't approve of talks. But that doesn't mean that talks aren't happening. I think negotiations are crucial. I don't think either side can gain a military victory. This has gone on for such a very long time. And yet, if you talk about a lasting peace, I think it has to be predicated on creation of jobs and incomes for people. Because when people are desperate, they have to feed their families, they have to find water, then given that the money that's in the country is wrapped up with military groups, you'll see continued cooperation with military groups. People don't want to do that, but they don't have other means of earning an income.
Tell us to what extent Afghanistan has been afflicted by this drought across the region.
Well, right now, out of 34 provinces in Afghanistan, 21 are afflicted by drought. And, you know, in drought-ridden countries, water wars break out, and it's hard to imagine that more water wars won't take place within Afghanistan. Already there's fighting going on over access to water or over creation of dams that moves water in a different direction. And when people flee, and they generally go to the cities, I'm most familiar with Kabul. These are cities that have been battered by war, and their water systems are already inadequate. And climate change has just dealt a terrible deck of cards to Afghanistan. You know, the water is contaminated. You have to boil every drop of drinking water. And, you know, it's humiliating for families if they can't get water for cleaning, for laundering.
Kathy, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to make sure to have you talk about the peace walk, where men have undertaken a walk advocating a peaceful resolution to this long conflict in Afghanistan. Tell us about this walk and the motivation for the folks engaged in the walk.
Well, you know, it's a real heart-in-your-throat sort of thing. Are they going to make it safely to Kabul? They're so vulnerable. They started out as 9 men, and they had done a 2-month vigil in the Helmand province following a suicide bombing. And they were in a tent. Women were in the tent as well, which is really unusual because this is such a conservative area. And they were asking that the Taliban and the Afghan government stop fighting. And these very determined people, even though other such vigils in other cities had kind of wrapped it up and said, you know, nobody's giving us a positive answer, that we don't hear negotiations surfacing from the government or from the Taliban. But they said, okay, we're going to roll up our tent, and they put on their sandals and declared intent to walk 434 miles from Helmand to Kabul. And they said, our walk will strengthen our movement. And they've been right. It's very heartening as they go to various cities. You know, they arrive and their feet are bloodied and blistered and torn. They are met by people who say, we are with you. And now their numbers have swelled. Dozens of people are walking. Throngs of people come to them when they arrive in cities. And when I was there, I heard from numerous people who said, yes, we approve of them. We're going to welcome them. So we have to hope that there won't be an attack when these very brave and yet very vulnerable people arrive in Kabul.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Learn more about Kelly's work and find a link to her recent article titled Digging Deeper by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The immigrant rights movement has been outraged and energized by the recent murder of 2 immigrant women on the U.S.-Mexico border and by the new Trump administration policy of separating parents seeking asylum in the U.S. from their children. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, often sends children of detained immigrants thousands of miles away, and many parents are not told where they are. In response to the violence and the government policy of separating families, protests were held across the U.S. in recent days. On June 7th, about 150 people gathered in Hartford, Connecticut, outside the federal building that houses Immigration Court, to denounce the killings and the separation of parents from their children. One Hartford protest organizer dipped her hand in red paint and applied handprints across the faces of a dozen protesters to symbolize the violence against immigrants at the border.
Activists from several groups spoke, followed by a die-in in front of the building, which police attempted to break up by threatening to arrest participants who didn't leave. Most opted to leave civil disobedience for another day. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the protest rally and brings us two of the speeches delivered there. We hear first from Mirka Dominguez Salinas, an organizer with the group Make the Road Connecticut.
Over 7,000 people have been killed. Let that sink in. This is not just a number. This, every single one was a person. And we at Make the Road envision a world where children aren't ripped apart from their families, where people aren't murdered for wanting a better education, where people aren't denied their basic human rights and die because of this. How many more have faced abuse and violence and lived through that and have to live with that trauma? There's no way that these numbers could ever be accurate. This violence and abuse is so systemic that we would never know the full extent of it. But it's spaces like this that we want to create and build community, because it's not going to take a day to change things. It's not going to take 2 days. It's not even going to take a month, right? It's going to take years of creating spaces like this to really change things. And on a local level, we've been working with families who, these two community members were walking down Franklin Ave and were detained, profiled or whatever it was. This is happening every day in our communities, okay? This is not just something that's happening in the news. Yes, it's happening at the national level, but it's happening in your neighborhoods. So we need to stand up against that and say, what is wrong with these people that they are tearing families apart? These two mothers are in danger of being deported. And that is not okay, and that is why we're here, because we won't stand for that.
That was Mirka Dominguez Salinas of Make the Road Connecticut. Next is Megan Fountain with Unidad Latina en Acción, who is in grad school at the University of Connecticut.
I'm studying history, so I wanted to share a little bit of the history of what we're seeing today, because what we're seeing today with immigrants in cages and children in cages is not new. Before the War on Terror by the George W. Bush administration, there was no ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It was Bush who created ICE and put immigration under the Department of Homeland Security and treated immigrants as terrorists and criminals. It was also Bush who started Operation Streamline. And we just heard Trump and Jeff Sessions announce that they are starting a zero tolerance policy, and every immigrant who turns themselves in at the border seeking asylum will get charged with a crime of illegal entry or illegal re-entry. Well, this is not new. This is Operation Streamline, which began in 2005. These are factories of courts, which make a mockery of justice. About 40 immigrants are brought into the courtroom, and they are tried en masse. That is not justice. They have maybe 1 minute to speak with a public defender before they plead guilty and they get sentenced to 6 months for illegal entry or up to 20 years for illegal re-entry. Now, unfortunately, this has been a bipartisan project, and the Obama administration increased prosecutions 130%. So that, yeah, you can say boo.
Boo!
So now illegal entry and illegal re-entry are the most prosecuted crimes in federal courts today. And Trump has pledged that 100% of people who come to the border, even people who come, mothers, fathers with children, who come and ask for asylum, which is recognized by the international community as a human right, they are now getting charged with a crime, and their children are being snatched away and put into cages. So, is this new?
No.
But are we going to end it?
Yes.
That was Megan Fountain, an activist with Unidad Latina en Acción, preceded by Mirka Dominguez Salinas, an organizer with the group Make the Road Connecticut. Learn more about local and national groups working for a fair immigration policy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller, counsel for the U.S. President argued that he, President Trump, had the inherent power to, if need be, pardon himself. The argument is a stunning one, but it's been coming since Election Day. Trump and his lawyers have essentially embraced the argument advanced by former President Richard Nixon, who, in an interview with the late David Frost, argued, "When a president does it, it's legal." Watergate cast that idea into the trash can of history until now. Presidents, like kings, are above the law. In 1974, the Supreme Court ruled in United States versus Nixon, as in Richard Nixon, the president, that no one, not even the president of the United States, is above the law. But King Donald I heeds another law, the law of power, the law of privilege, the law of wealth. You think he or his lawyers give a fig about the Supreme Court? They serve King Donald, and he serves himself. Imagine the scene. "I, Donald Trump, hereby pardons Donald Trump." Signed, Donald Trump. We are in a madhouse. One of America's own making. The King Donald Trump Show, live from Imprisoned Nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
the first clip that you're going to hear, Mumia addresses what Steve and I were just talking about, the mythology that informs the American narrative as it is fed to Americans. Let's listen.
So when we speak of key defects of U.S. history, we must be mindful of the fact that all countries have founding myths drawn to inculcate the young into adoration of the nation, which really shows us why school kids get so much bunk in history class, and why most Americans grow up with such myths and still hold them as sacred. We've got to remember that different populations in the U.S. have quite different histories from other parts of the country. Consider this. Isn't it simply logical that blacks, Indians, and WASP whites have profoundly different understandings of history? They each experienced America differently, right? When Americans went abroad, they would point to the Constitution to show foreigners how just the nation was when it came to black people. They could point to the so-called Reconstruction Amendments to show that black folks had constitutional rights. In fact, after Reconstruction, those rights written in the Constitution were eliminated by state laws which supported white supremacy and disenfranchised blacks from voting, from jury service, and a whole lot more. So history, true history, shows us what's underneath the promises, you dig? Also, we try to address and engage all of the communities and histories from an anti-imperialist perspective. So Murder, Inc. seeks to tell the stories of regular people who made historical contributions to making and remaking America. Those excluded millions.
There you have the remarkable articulate voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And Steve, as he described his sense of the American mythology, the regional histories, I'm thinking of the clash in the summer of 2017 in Charlottesville, Virginia, which was a seat of Jim Crow discrimination against African Americans. And it was the scene of this protest and counter-protest. The protesters were deploring the removal of Civil War-era statuary, and the counter-protesters, of course, were objecting to the parade of neo-Nazis and white supremacists on the streets of Charlottesville. As we look at this, we see that what you expose in the deep history of the United States still exists in different virulent forms. For example, Mumia referred to the restrictions by states on the constitutional rights of African Americans related to voting. And in 2016, we saw the most elaborate voter suppression scheme run by Republicans aimed primarily at likely Democrats, and that includes large swaths of the African American community. And in particular, in Detroit and in Milwaukee, those were critical areas where the voter suppression allowed Trump to eke out a margin of victory, only 11,000 votes in the state of Michigan. And we know that there were 75,000 ballots in Detroit where people voted for Congress or Senate or other offices, but mysteriously cast no vote for president. And that suggests that the optical scanners were manipulated to produce no vote for the Democrat. And this is now seen, it's now reported as lower turnout by African Americans in the 2016 election.
Well, we continue to live this myth that America is living in this post-racial period. You know, that was the myth that was put forth when Barack Obama was elected to the White House. And it couldn't be further from the truth. And I think that one of the great reasons that I know Mumia wanted to dig his teeth in on this book was the idea that this American berserk, a term that Philip Roth coined, the late Philip Roth, great American novelist, coined. We are still living with, and he realizes that the future, to get over this obstacle, this dying dinosaur of racism and sexism and just this ultimate American berserk that we watch every day, day in and day out, can really only be rectified and changed by young people. Give young people another chance. You know, it happened a bit in the 60s, and a lot of that great soul that was cultivated in the 1960s, a great part of it sold out. Not everybody, but a great part of it sold out. Had to, or we wouldn't be sitting in the position where we are right now. But it's so important for young people to embrace this book. And we tried like hell to make this book not just, you know, your father's history book, as you talked about in the very beginning, but something that was spirited, that was irreverent, that was funny. You know, bringing back Philip Roth, he had this suggestion that the deadly serious and sheer playfulness in both fiction and nonfiction could exist side by side. And I think Murder Incorporated is a great example of that. We tried to bring in comedians, songs, poetry.
Another school, another massacre. We thought, foolishly, that the school killings in Florida were a turning point. Demonstrations across the country raged against mass murders, the National Rifle Association gun lobby, and impotent politicians wanting to pray rather than pass laws to protect children. Until now. Until a teenager in Texas, spurned by a girl, explodes at a high school and sends 10 people to the next world. Here we go again. No national politician, from the president to local mayor, has a clue. Not one. This is America at the first quarter of a new century. Nothing even comes close. We tire, for it's all too familiar. Young men, lonely, alone, and unloved, fueled by explosive testosterone, turn school grounds into the wild, wild west, and teach lessons of death in classrooms, launching themselves, if they survive, into the modern-day dungeons of prison and loss. What can we do? Nothing. Nothing. Until the next time. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Is there any justification for Israel's ongoing blockade against Gaza and the recent violence against protesters at the border fence? Could a boycott of Israel's diamond industry meaningfully impact the application of its apartheid policies? How did Jews the world over go from resisting a political movement known as Zionism to embracing it as part of their identity? Does the administration of Benjamin Netanyahu represent a fundamental change in the Zionist expansionist policies, or is it a natural progression of an existing program? What are the forces driving international support for Israel and passivity in the face of that state's war crimes? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, at a time when violence in the Israel-Palestine conflict is making major world headlines, we'll take a closer look at some of the dynamics playing out in the region with three guests. We'll hear from Ron Russo, one of the Canadians participating in this year's Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. We'll hear from Palestine solidarity activist and writer Sean Clinton about the role of blood diamonds in perpetuating Israeli violence. And we'll get a historical perspective from Université de Montréal history professor and author Yaakov Rabkin. On this week's program, Violence with Impunity, the Unending Tragedy of the Israeli Occupation. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 8th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Gaikin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiwa of Dakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. A bipartisan majority of the House adopted the National Defense Authorization Act on May 24th with a vote of 351 to 66. The bill now moves to the Senate. If the Senate version ultimately includes the Ellison Amendment as well, Congress would send a clear message to Donald Trump that he has no statutory authority to militarily attack Iran. This becomes particularly significant in light of Trump's May 8th withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. That withdrawal was followed by a long list of demands by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, which could set the stage for a U.S. attack on Iran. That comes from the article, In Unanimous Vote, House Says No Legal Right to Attack Iran, by Professor Marjorie Cohn, post June 7th, originally appearing at Truth Out. The killing of Razan Najjar, the 22-year-old medical volunteer shot by an Israeli sniper in Gaza on Friday, is the latest tragic reminder of the outrageous and indiscriminate brutality being meted out under orders from the Netanyahu government. The silence, or worse, support for this flagrant illegality from many Western governments, including our own, has been shameful. Instead of standing by while these shocking killings and abuses take place, they should take a lead from Israeli peace and justice campaigners to demand an end to the multiple abuses of human and political rights Palestinians face on a daily basis, the 11-year siege of Gaza, the continuing 50-year occupation of Palestinian territory, and the ongoing expansion of illegal settlements. President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital city and move the U.S. embassy there, in violation of international agreements, has demonstrated that the U.S. has no claim to be any kind of honest broker for a political settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict. A sustainable, just peace between Israelis and Palestinians that recognizes the rights and security of all and puts an end to the continuing dispossession of the Palestinian people is an interest we all share in the Middle East and far beyond. That comes from the article, The West is Turning a Blind Eye to the Gaza Massacre, by Jeremy Corbyn, posted June 7th, originally appearing on Jerry Corbyn's Facebook page. The debate over free speech on campus to allow conservative voices is much in the media, but the desire of many of America's normally liberal Jews to curtail any and all criticism of Israel is hardly mentioned at all, even though it is in many respects far more serious an attack against the First Amendment, as support of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement would be enshrined in federal legislation with draconian penalties attached. Two leading Jewish senators, Ben Cardin of Maryland and Chuck Schumer of New York, are the driving forces behind the so-called Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which is continuing to make its way through Congress. It was introduced by Cardin and quickly attracted a number of co-sponsors and supporters, many of whom were predictably Republicans. The irony inherent in the bill comes from the fact that both Cardin and Schumer are solidly liberal in their voting records, to include support of issues generally regarded as protective of constitutional rights and liberties. Theirs might reasonably be considered reliable votes whenever the Bill of Rights is challenged, but when it comes to Israel, they are quite willing to flip 180 degrees. That comes from the article, "They Disagree on Everything But Israel," by Philip Giraldi, posted June 7th, originally appearing at American Free Press. Argentina's cancellation of a friendly against Israel because of Israeli attempts to exploit the match politically is likely to reverberate far beyond the world of soccer and spotlights the risks of Israeli efforts to persuade the international community to recognize Jerusalem as its capital. The Argentinian decision suggests that despite the fact several countries, including East European nations, are debating whether to follow U.S. President Donald J. Trump's decision earlier this year to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the Jewish state and move the U.S. embassy to the city, Israel is likely to find it difficult to capitalize on the U.S. move in ways that convincingly project widespread international support. Even worse, the decision illustrates that efforts to force recognition could backfire. The Argentinian move has buoyed the grassroots Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, or BDS campaign that seeks to isolate Israel in nonviolent defense of Palestinian rights after Israel has made countering the movement one of its top foreign policy objectives. The cancellation of Israel's friendly match with Argentina is a boost to the Red Card Israel campaign, which has called on FIFA to expel Israel, as it expelled apartheid South Africa, due to its violations against Palestinian football and its disregard for FIFA statutes, BDS said in a statement. That comes from the article. Israel scores painful own goal in run-up to the World Cup. Argentina cancels friendly match with Israel, by James M. Dorsey, posted June 7th, originally appearing on the Turbulent World of Middle East Soccer blog. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In the past 2 months, the world has witnessed a flare-up of violence along the Israel-Gaza border, resulting in the deadliest days of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict since the 2014 Gaza War. The Palestinian Great March of Return, organized by independent activists but backed by Hamas and other major factions within the Gaza Strip, was intended as a demand that Palestinian refugees and their descendants be allowed to return to areas from which they were expelled during the creation of the State of Israel. It was also a protest of the decade-long blockade of the Gaza Strip by Israel and Egypt, and of the decision to move the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. On the Gaza side, over 13,000 people were injured since March 30th, when the campaign began, more than 120 killed. The dead and injured have included journalists and medics, including Canadian Dr. Tarek Loubani and a 21-year-old Palestinian nurse named Razan Ashraf Najjar, who died on Friday, June 1st. No Israeli defense forces have yet been killed, even though Israeli officials have defended and praised IDF actions as self-defense against planned attacks by Hamas against Israel. Palestinian resistance has been motivated by a blockade of Gaza, which has had devastating effects on the health of the population, especially coming on top of two violent assaults on Gaza over the course of a decade. A number of citizens around the world have responded to the need to assist. One tactic is to nonviolently penetrate the blockade on the ocean side through what is called a freedom flotilla. So far, none of these vessels have been able to make it to shore successfully without being intercepted by Israeli Defense Forces. Ron Russo is one of the Canadians taking part in this year's Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. He's a postal worker, president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, Whitehorse Local, Indigenous Vice President of the Canadian Labour Congress, a father and a grandfather, and he lives in the traditional territory of the Carcross Takish First Nation in Yukon. He's been traveling on board the flotilla ship Al-Oda and joined us by phone after a stop at the port at La Rochelle, France. Could I ask you what inspired you to take part in this action?
Well, for me, it's a human rights issue. It's a human rights issue as we see what's going on with the people, the lack of food, you know, the land prison where you need a pass to come and go, where, you know, unemployment's at less than 50%. And it's a struggle. You know, there's 80% of people are living off of aid. The water is limited. The electricity is limited to 1 to 2 hours a day. It could be the middle of the night for cooking. And it's all being limited by the Israelis. So we feel that it's a human rights issue. And then for me, as an Indigenous person, is when we look at the United Nations definition of Indigenous, is they fall into it as well, right? So, you know, we're all people of Mother Earth, and we all need to be taking care of one another, and we need to make sure that we know what's going forward. So I think it's really important, and that we need to take care of one another and make sure that we're all being respected.
Mm. Now, it just so happens, I mean, you made the decision to take part in this before the recent flare-up of violence along the Israeli border. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about some of the statements you're hearing by Israeli officials and their supporters who attempt to justify the actions at the border fence and in maintaining the blockade as necessary self-defense against terrorists.
Right. You know, for us going in, it's a little bit terrifying. I'm actually not going to be going all the way in. I'm going to be going two more stops, and then the boat will continue with new people getting on and off. So I'll be spending 3 weeks on the boat, but I will not be going all the way into the Gaza. But as far as what's just happened recently there was a nurse that was shot, somebody that was providing aid. With their hands in the air, is my understanding from the news reports that we've seen. Then there was retaliation. And so all of a sudden it ended up being that it was their fault and that they, meanwhile, the tensions are high. And I think that was just one more push to be edging them on, to be having some type of recourse. And the recourse was swift and it's unjust.
Hmm. Now, you just pointed out the parallels between Israeli's treatment of the Palestinian population and Canada's treatment of the indigenous population here. I mean, both cases you're talking about indigenous populations. Did the parallels? What do those parallels say to you in the midst of a Canadian government that makes a lot of talk about reconciliation?
Well, you know, when we look back at history, is we look at where we were in the past. You know, we ended up being put into reservations. We needed a similar path for people to leave. Then we ended up with the residential schools. And even today, there's still many issues for Indigenous children in Canada, you know, with less than a third of the amount of money going to per child. For Indigenous children, but you know, when we look back at history and the government of what's going on, as we saw Pierre Trudeau sit down and come up with the white paper, which was to pretty much assimilate all of the Indigenous people in Canada. So now we have his son that's in, and Justin, you know, bought up a pipeline, and you know, Indigenous people in Canada are infuriated with what's going on, because you know, we have an agreement with uh, um, pardon me, with the
So I thought you may have been talking about the buyout of the Kinder Morgan, but you're talking about
So it has a lot to do with the buyout of the Kinder Morgan and the informed consent. And as we've seen, as the indigenous people are quite upset about what's happening across the country, and you know, stepping up and pushing it forward. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you spoke in very general and appropriate terms about the parallels there. You know, the indigenous populations of both Israel and Canada. I'm wondering if there is maybe a specific incident or a specific example that sticks out in your mind when you reflect at the parallels between, you know, maybe what's happened to somebody in Palestine, in Gaza, and what's happening in indigenous territory here in Canada.
Here in Canada is, you know, when we look at what's going on inside of Palestine, of you know, the lack of clean drinking water, and we look at the lack of food, and when we look at Canada, you know, we still have almost 140 First Nations without clean drinking water. We still have, instead of Northern Canada, it costs 4 to 5 times more to feed your family than it does inside of the South. So I think that the government's made lots of promises, but we still have to see action.
Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you for sharing these thoughts on the as you are preparing to go further along this unique action. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners about this about the action or about what's happening to Gazans right now that you'd like to express?
Yeah, you know, I think that people really need to take a look away from the mainstream media, especially what's coming out of you know, the Israeli camps, some of the American news, and they need to take a look about what's actually happening and look beyond the frontline stories and look at this as a human rights issue of people, you know, people's children, people's grandchildren, people's parents. These are people that this is happening to, and it's not, as they say, about people who are terrorists. You know, most of these people are university people, children, and that are getting up and standing up for what's happening to them inside this land prison, and being shot for it and called terrorists. So I think that we need to really look at the definition of what people are calling terrorists.
It's been a privilege and a pleasure speaking with you, Ron. Good luck on your journey and all the best.
Thank you very much.
That was Ron Rousseau. He's one of the Canadians taking part in the 2018 Freedom Flotilla to Gaza on board the ship Al Oda. He joined us from La Rochelle, France, on Thursday, June 7th. For more details on this year's flotilla and how you can help, please visit the site freedomflotilla.org. And Canadian listeners can also visit the site canadaboatgaza.org. According to Palestine Solidarity activist Sean Clinton, the massacres being committed in Gaza over the last few weeks could have been prevented if human rights watchdogs had spoken up about it at an April OECD forum on responsible mineral supply chains in Paris. Clinton was alluding to the Israeli state's lucrative diamond industry, which he wrote about at length in a May 23rd article posted at Global Research. We got in touch with Mr. Clinton at his home in Limerick, Ireland, to elaborate on the state's dependence on blood diamonds.
Israel is a major player in the global diamond industry, and they were talking there about mineral supplies, responsible mineral supplies, and that was the perfect opportunity to raise the issue of an OECD member, a leading member in the global diamond industry, that was using revenue from the diamond industry to fund its war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza, and nobody saw fit to open their mouths about it. If they had done it at that stage and raised the question about the ethical provenance of diamonds that are cut and polished in Israel, I think Israel would have had to think twice about their actions in Gaza, and we may not have had the massacre on the 14th of May that subsequently followed.
So could you talk then about just a little bit about this, the background of the diamond industry in Israel?
It's a hugely important industry. In fact, it's so important to the Israeli economy that whenever you study Israeli economic statistics, it's always mentioned their exports, excluding diamonds, because the diamonds are so far more valuable than any other sector of the Israeli economy, that to include them, to talk about them in the same graphs or publications, it would skew the publication so much. And this is a factor. This is a fact that's been mentioned in a recent article in Haaretz, I think it said, about the diamond industry. Israel's diamond industry accounts for about 30% of their manufacturing exports. It's far more valuable than their electronics or their pharmaceuticals or any other sector of the economy, but yet nobody is focusing on this. And for good reason, Israel never mentions their diamond industry because they know well that it's the Israeli brand image is purely toxic for the diamond brand image. So you never hear mention of their burgeoning diamond exports. They're always on about their electronics and their high tech. But in fact, their diamond exports are far more valuable than the electronics or the any other high tech or pharmaceutical exports.
Hmm. Now, there's been processes in place to try to control or limit the amount of proceeds that are generated by, you know, what's been called conflict diamonds, to prevent the earnings from the diamonds getting into promoting human rights aggression. So could you maybe help us, first of all, explain what you mean by blood diamonds as opposed to conflict diamonds? And
well, yeah, it might be worth explaining that for your listeners. In 2003, this Kimberley process came into being. It's a system of self-regulation introduced by the diamond industry in response to growing public rejection of diamonds because of the links between diamond industry and bloody civil wars, particularly in Africa. So the diamond industry was forced to react and to introduce regulations to control they were supposed to eliminate the trade in blood diamonds. But what they did, in fact, was rather than banning all blood diamonds, they came up with this new term called conflict diamonds. And the definition of a conflict diamond is very restrictive. It applies only to rough diamonds, for a start, and those rough diamonds that are used by rebel groups to fund violence against legitimate governments. Therefore, straight away, all cut and polished diamonds are unregulated, totally unregulated, and rough diamonds that fund rogue regimes guilty of gross human rights violations are also unregulated. So what the diamond industry does then, it keeps talking about conflict diamonds, all our diamonds are conflict-free, they say then as well, and completely ignoring the fact that other diamonds that aren't conflict diamonds but are in fact blood diamonds because they're funding rogue regimes guilty of human rights violations, such as the regime in Zimbabwe and the regime in Angola, which also uses revenue from diamonds to fund gross human rights violations there. But because those human rights violations are perpetrated by government forces, their diamonds are excluded from the regulations, just the same as Israel's diamonds are excluded from all regulation because the violence in Israel is being committed by government forces. So the jewelry industry claims that these diamonds are conflict-free, based on the fact that they are in compliance with the Kimberley process, which only bans conflict diamonds that fund rebel groups guilty of human rights violations.
So
it's a massive scam, and it's something that that CEOs in particular of public companies such as Anglo America, which owns De Beers, and Signet is one of the biggest jewelry companies in America and Europe, and these companies are all selling diamonds. They're major buyers of diamonds from Israel, and they're selling these diamonds, claiming that they're conflict-free, simply because these diamonds are in compliance with the Kimberley process. But as I said, the Kimberley process only bans diamonds that fund rebels. It doesn't ban diamonds that fund rogue regimes.
Mm. So, yeah, it sounds like this is almost like the International Criminal Court, where you only prosecute African leaders, but you don't prosecute United States for Iraq or whatever.
Yeah, they want everybody to focus on Africa, and the rough diamonds in Africa. Don't ignore the cut and polished diamonds that we see in the big jewelry stores on our high streets. They'll tell you they're all conflict free. It's an absolute lie. It's a fraud, because 20% of those diamonds in value terms are cut and polished in Israel, processed in Israel, but nobody has any way of telling if a diamond is. When you go into a jewelry store to buy a diamond, you can't tell where it was cut and polished where it's from. Once they're cut and polished, you can't distinguish one from the other unless they're hallmarked, and most diamonds aren't hallmarked. And that's you're buying something that could be worth thousands and thousands of dollars or euros, and yet you have no idea where, even the jeweler behind the counter has no idea where it was cut and polished. He can't distinguish one diamond from the other.
Could you explain why Amnesty International, Global Witness, and then the other human rights organizations aren't, why don't they seem to be wanting to press for more sanctions against Israel?
It is very difficult to explain that. I've talked to some of these organizations, and they're focused on particular aspects of the diamond trade. Just recently, in February, Human Rights Watch brought out a major report into the jewelry industry where they scrutinized the supply chains of 13 major jewelry jewelers. But their scrutiny ended abruptly at the mine gate. They only looked at where they were getting the diamonds, the mining sector, and completely ignored human rights violations being funded by revenue from the diamond industry further along the supply chain as the diamonds are cut and polished and processed. So it was a major loophole in their, a major failing in the report. And they gave Tiffany's top ranking, despite the fact that until last year, Tiffany's, the global iconic jeweler, was sourcing diamonds from the Benny's Diamonds Group Resources mine in Sierra Leone. But in 2017, very interestingly, they quietly divested from the Diamonds Group, following a BDS campaign which put pressure on them, exposing the links between the Steinmetz Group, which had adopted a unit of the Gavati Brigade and funded and supported them during the Operation Protective Edge in Gaza, when the Gavati Brigade was responsible for the slaughter of the Samouni family, the massacre of the Samouni family in Gaza. And yet Tiffany's continued to buy diamonds from the Steinmetz Group and claim they were conflict-free, even though the Steinmetz Group had adopted a unit of the Gavati Brigade.
And what about your opinion about these Palestine solidarity campaigns, BDS campaigns, and so on? Why they don't seem to be more focused on blood diamonds?
Well, this is something I've been trying to encourage groups to get involved in. And right now, I think that the most effective, the most practical and economically significant sanction, which would obliterate Israel's impunity, would be to expose and isolate the Israeli blood diamond industry, which has been described as a cornerstone of the economy and as one of the main arteries funding the criminal Zionist regime. It, as I said, it generates $1 billion per year for the IOF alone. And so with the EU now chairing the Kimberley process and a meeting coming up in 2 weeks' time in Antwerp, it's the perfect opportunity to raise the issue and put pressure on our elected representatives in Europe to call for Israel to be expelled from the Kimberley process, just as Zimbabwe was expelled from the Kimberley process when government forces in Zimbabwe killed 200 miners in 2008. Zimbabwe was subsequently expelled from the Kimberley process and only in recent years was allowed back in after they tidied up their act. But after Israel's recent slaughter in Gaza, they should not be allowed to sell their diamonds on the open market. They should not be allowed to contaminate the market with these blood diamonds, which are funding gross human rights violations in Gaza on a daily basis. And even in the West Bank as well, we heard this morning that another member of the Tamimi family was shot and killed by Israeli forces in Ali Sabah. Ali Sabah.
Yeah. Well, Sean, I want to thank you very much for bringing this information to our attention. I think it's a particularly important time to raise the issue of the blood diamond industry and the Israelis' involvement in it. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We've been joined by Sean Clinton. He is based in Limerick, Ireland, and he is active with Palestine Solidarity Struggles. You can find some of his articles at the Electronic Intifada and globalresearch.ca.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
While the U.S. comes to the defense of Israel, successfully blocking a call at the UN to condemn Israeli actions, other countries have been registering their opposition. Recently, Argentina announced it was canceling a football World Cup warm-up match with Israel, apparently having yielded to pressure from its domestic population. To get some insights into the forces driving Israeli violence and where this is all headed, we got in touch with Yaakov Rabkin. Yaakov M. Rabkin is professor of history at the Université du Montréal and a founding member of Canada's Independent Jewish Voices. His recent books are A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism by Zed Palgrave Macmillan, and What is Modern Israel by Pluto University of Chicago Press. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Rabkin.
My pleasure.
So let's put the events of the last 2 months within that historical context, which you could speak to. Could you outline who is behind this Zionist project? I mean, and maybe speak about this the issues, the factors that have shaped this project that is Israel.
The Zionist project is a political movement that emerged in the end of the 19th century. Or to be more precise, it involved Jews at the end of the 19th century, because prior to that time, the idea of ingathering Hebrews into the Holy Land had become rather popular among certain English-speaking Protestant denominations in England and in North America. And this, which we would call anachronistically Christian Zionists, these Christian Zionists got quite a bit of popularity, particularly in Britain in the 19th century, with Lord Shaftesbury and many other politicians seeing an opportunity in creating, so to speak, a Jewish state in a strategically very important region. However, till the very end of the 19th century, there were no Jewish takers for this project. Why? Because the biblical prophecy that the Protestants interpreted literally, according to what Protestants usually do, they have a direct, immediate relationship with biblical text. Jewish tradition reinterprets this biblical prophecy, these biblical prophecies, and the standard Jewish attitude towards return to the Holy Land is one of messianic expectation, of messianic yearning, but essentially political passivity. What changed at the end of the 19th century as a result of this Christian Zionist influence is that some people of Jewish descent who were quite removed from the Jewish tradition, and that's why they embraced the Zionist idea, like Theodor Herzl and a group of German-speaking intellectuals in Vienna and in Germany, they created this movement with the first Zionist Congress taking place in 1897 in Basel, Switzerland. And it's interesting also why it happened in Basel, Switzerland, because it's a small, relatively small Jewish community. Because they wanted to have this first Zionist Congress in Munich, but the organized Jewish community of Germany put pressure on the German government to forbid such a meeting in Munich. It shows you how much opposition was generated to the Zionist idea from Jews, both assimilated and, of course, from more pious, more observant Jews. So this is the background. That's a Jewish movement that began then, really was a movement of a few intellectuals, so to speak, generals without an army. But the foot soldiers of Zionism didn't come from Austria or from Germany or from France, for that matter. They came from the Russian Empire. And the importance of the Russian dimension is still very great, because Jews at that time in the Russian Empire at the turn of the 20th century lived under official discrimination. They could not move around the country. They had to live in a certain area. And there was a lot of frustration. So that frustration took various ways of expressing itself. One of them was joining the Zionist movement. And even though the number of settlers from Russian Empire to Palestine was quite small, they played a crucial role in the creation of the Zionist project in Palestine and the political direction that it took. Till today, all the prime ministers of Israel were either born in the Russian Empire or their parents were born in the Russian Empire. And their main idea was to occupy the land and create a separate society, a separate economy, a separate state eventually, that would be a way of creating a new, totally different society from the Jewish continuity as it existed then. So this is the background of the Zionist project.
Could you explain that the evolution, because as you've indicated in your writings, the majority of Jews were opposed to Zionism in the beginning, and yet today it seems, at least you know, looking in whether it's within Israel or even in Canada, the United States, it seems as if you know, people conceive Zionism as a response to the you know, the need to protect Jews from anti-Semitic governments, be they Germany or wherever. How did we see that transformation in the popular imagination to the point where anti-Zionism is practically equated with anti-Semitism?
Well, I think this is a tremendous success of the Zionist movement and later of the State of Israel to conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. The late Abba Eben, brilliant foreign minister of Israel, considered it a very important objective to reach in order to strengthen Israel's position in the world. And I think to that extent, it has succeeded. The opposition to Zionism was of two varieties, roughly. One was from Jews who wanted to be part of their societies. And when the Zionists came and said, well, you don't really belong here, you belong to a separate nation that should live in Palestine, that paralleled quite nicely the anti-Semitic message that Jews don't belong, that they are alien, that they are pernicious alien element. And that's why Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism, said very clearly in his diaries that anti-Semites will be our best allies and friends. So for Jews who wanted to integrate into their society, Zionism was a threat. For religious, more observant circles, who actually till today are not Zionist, the Zionist project was a profanation of Judaism, a secularization of the biblical messages, a literal reading of it, which Jews never accepted. So for them, the entire Zionist project was something to be rejected, and it's still rejected, because if you see how the so-called ultra-Orthodox react to the Zionist state and, for example, to the law obliging them to go to the army, which they don't. There was a demonstration in Jerusalem a few years ago when one of my books came out in Hebrew in Israel. It so happened that there was a demonstration of 500,000 Jews against military service, and they were all very observant, you know, in black and white clothing. So this is the second part. Now, how did it happened that today most Jews accept the ultra-Orthodox, support Zionism. Moreover, they see that their Jewishness is, in fact, support for Israel. Many of them don't do anything else Jewish. You see, it became very clear that today a Jew can transgress the Sabbath and eat not kosher food and transgress all the other commandments, and he would still be accepted as part of Jewish community. But if he or she criticizes Israel, then it becomes really difficult. Now, how did it happen? Well, it happened in stages. Many descendants of Russian Jews in North America in particular took control of Jewish organizations, which had been in the hands of German Jews who were quite opposed or at least neutral with respect to Zionism. So this Russian dimension also permeated Jewish communities in North America. Then the Second World War happened with the Nazi genocide that exterminated millions of Jews. And that, of course, affected many people, including political leaders, who saw in the Zionist project a way of, so to speak, solving the Jewish problem. But the real support for Israel didn't begin before 1967, before the Six-Day War, when Israel attacked its neighbors, occupied territories, and came out as a valiant, triumphant nation. It's after that that Jewish communities began supporting Israel, identifying with Israel, and that coincided with a very important educational project that was conceived in Jerusalem and carried out in practically all non-ultra-Orthodox communities around the world, that is to teach the centrality of Israel for Jewish identity. And this has become a reality. I think today the vast majority of non-ultra-Orthodox Jews in North America, in France, and elsewhere, identify with Israel as something that constitutes their Jewish identity. My colleague from Tel Aviv University, Shlomo Sand, caustically remarked that 100 years ago, if someone would say that a French Jew doesn't belong to the French nation, that person would be considered an anti-Semite. Today, if you say that French Jews do not constitute a separate nation but belong to the French nation, that would be considered anti-Semitism. That shows how the term anti-Semitism really was turned upside down. And that happened to many terms in history. And this is another concept that came to mean something totally different from what it was in the end of the 19th century when the term anti-Semitism was coined.
So I'm wondering now, in the modern day, we have Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and it does seem as if the rhetoric about, you know, protecting the Jewish state and, you know, the enemies in Iran and elsewhere is certainly upped quite substantially. I'm wondering if his prime ministership, does it represent a particular turning point, or is this merely an expansion of a long-standing expansionist project?
No, I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu, who has been quite effective, incidentally, in mobilizing support of Christian Zionists in the United States when he was Israeli representative at the United Nations. Prime Minister Netanyahu, I think, represents a continuity of Zionism, a continuity of the Zionist project. And in fact, Netanyahu is today to the left of his own government. He's definitely not the most hawkish member of it. What he has done, and I think that's, again, a standard procedure, he tried to solidify support for himself and for Israel by indicating that Israel always faces its existential threats. Well, many political leaders have indicated or invented threats in order to solidify their support. So Netanyahu has done that quite successfully, and particularly with Iran, he opposed the treaty that was concluded in 2015 between the six nations and Iran, and he succeeded. To a large extent, it was his work that the United States recently withdrew from that treaty. So I think that Netanyahu is a true Zionist, and also he positions himself very explicitly, more explicitly than others, as the leader of the entire Jewish people, not just of the people of Israel who elected him. This is something new, and that tends to blur distinctions between Jews in other countries and Israelis, which of course endangers Jews, because Jews are very often wrongly accused for what Israel does, even though Jews around the world, however wealthy and however important, have no political influence in Israel whatsoever, but they become hostages of what Israel does and is. So it's a win-win situation for Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he's been very, very, very successful in advancing this agenda.
You mentioned Christian Zionism and that being a factor in some countries like the United States, but Zionist organizations and Christian Zionist organizations, they're a minority even within the United States, and it seems to me that there has to be some other motivation, like for the United States, Canada, and other international players to continue endorsing the Zionist project, or at least sort of looking the other way when we're seeing the kind of violence that we've seen recently in Gaza. What are those factors that are contributing to the foreign support for the Israeli actions that we're seeing?
Well, let me start by correcting what you just said. I don't think the Christian Zionists are a minority or a marginal group. They themselves claim that they are from 50 to 80 million people in the United States. I must remind your listeners that the number of Jews in the entire world is about 14 million. So we're talking about a much more massive support for Zionism from Christians than it is from Jews. And, of course, the inauguration of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem included two prominent Christian Zionist leaders. That was clearly a message sent back to the United States that President Trump hears them and is sensitive to their plight. Now, of course, Christian Zionist does not explain everything. Much more important, in my opinion, is the position that Israel has come to occupy as a purveyor of security know-how and security equipment, as a major source of defense materiel and high-tech surveillance technologies. So Israel has become an indispensable source of all that precisely because of the ongoing oppression of Palestinians that requires Israel to become inventive, to test their new technology on Palestinians, and therefore their exports to a large extent consist of high-tech security and military equipment and know-how. That is a very important factor that explains the impunity which Israel enjoys in many Western capitals. Another important reason is that Israel is seen as an island of Western influence in the Middle East, in Western Asia, and this is a function that the Zionist leaders had cherished from the very beginning, to be an island as they saw it, in a barbaric region. So for all these reasons, Israel is very useful to Western governments, and particularly in the larger context in which we live. And the larger context is that of a growing gap between rich and poor, and that requires more sophisticated methods of crowd control, of oppression of population, of surveillance, and Israel is very useful as a source of that. So in the larger context of neoliberal economics and the growing frustration of people around the world, including in Western countries, Israeli means of controlling population are very handy, very useful, and I think that's a niche that Israel occupies with tremendous success.
Could you comment on the historic significance of the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem?
Well, I wouldn't ascribe to its historic significance. I think that it's a symbolic gesture that sort of consecrates U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I don't think that it really changes very much because it had been clear from practically all the previous administrations in Washington for the last 20 years that the U.S. stood behind Israel and vetoed all attempts to criticize Israel. So I think President Trump did something which is perfectly within the logic of U.S. attitude towards Israel, because the U.S. government, in the way, spoke mouths on the one hand, two sides of the mouth. On the one hand, it criticized the expansion of settlements on the West Bank. On the other, it provided Israel with huge amounts of support. So now that hypocrisy is largely ended, and I think that President Trump, for all his other failings, can be congratulated for being quite honest and direct in what he did.
Now, given the powers that are backing the Israeli government internally and externally, the rise of the non-Jewish population within Israel and the success of Palestine solidarity movements, where do you see the conflict heading? Possibly a unitary Jewish-Palestinian state, a two-state solution, or will Israel successfully conquer the Golan and continue to expand its territories?
Well, that question should be put to a prophet, not to a professor of history.
Based on past trends, you might say.
Sorry, I didn't hear.
Sorry, just like looking at the current trajectory.
Right. What I can see is the idea of a two-state, a Palestinian state and the Israeli state, that idea has been dead for quite a while, simply because of the expansion of Israeli settlements around the West Bank. So what other ways? I think there are several scenarios, but I think that looking for the future distracts us from looking at the present. And what we have in the present is a territory from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, entirely controlled by Israel, with Israeli currency, with Israeli economy, and the Israeli army. So if we don't look at formalities, we could just see that Israel has become one state, because it is one state. Palestinian Authority or Hamas doesn't exercise much control over their territory. Any Israeli soldier, any 18-year-old recruit, has more power than Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. And we could see that in this recent violence of Israeli troops against Gaza. So I think that what we see today is a territory controlled by Israel in which some people have political rights and others don't. Some people have more economic privilege than others. So we see essentially a perpetuation of a situation that has existed since 1967 and, in fact, had existed before. We shouldn't forget that the Arab population of what became the State of Israel in 1948 lived under military rule for, I think, 15 years. So what we see today is, in a way, a continuation of it. And while the rest of the world, including you, are questioning what is going to be the solution. There may not be any solution. That may be just perpetuation of the current state, which is quite comfortable for Israel. It's certainly today Palestinians don't represent an existential threat. As I said, they're also a very useful ground for testing new weapons. So I don't think that Israel is looking for solutions. I think Israel looks rather for a continuation of the status quo.
And just a final thought about what the larger community, what sorts of activities or what sorts of lobbying should they be enacting in order to realize a more a just turn of events?
Well, I think what there is a tremendous democratic deficit in Western support for Israel. In other words, governments support Israel, but the population doesn't support it to the same extent or doesn't support it at all. That is the case in Canada, incidentally, where the position of the Canadian government on Israel is not supported by the population. However, I don't expect any government in the world to lose power because it supports Israel. It's not an electoral issue, so to speak. So what we see is that we have many grassroots movements, including the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. We have demonstrations. We have sometimes cancellation of football matches, as you mentioned in the beginning. So these are unpleasant events for the government of Israel and for the, I think, for Israeli society. But I don't think it, at this point, affects what Israel is and does. It actually provided Prime Minister Netanyahu at one point with the opportunity to say that the BDS is the existential threat to Israel. But honestly, boycotting Israeli oranges is important, but no one is boycotting import of Israeli high-tech military weapons. And they constitute a lot more in the exports of Israel than the oranges. So I think for mobilizing support for Palestinians, for sort of serious critique of Israel, these movements are important. So far, they have not changed anything in the behavior of the Israeli government. And I would say that I don't see in the future that they can. Israeli government is very strong. Israeli society is fully behind it. And I think it's very important to understand that Israel is a democratic country, and what you see in the behavior of the Israeli government and the Israeli army is what Israeli majority, or at least non-Arab majority, wants. Some people say, well, the government, Benjamin Netanyahu, is betraying the ideals of Zionism. I don't think so. I think he is in a straight line from Ben-Gurion and on. And the Israeli society, as I just said, elects him and elects much more right-wing and much more nationalistic parliamentarians. So I think Israel in that sense is quite consolidated.
I want to thank you very much, Professor Rabkin, for sharing your thoughts and your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you. All the best.
We've been speaking with Montreal-based scholar and author Yaakov Rabkin. Many of his articles are posted at the Global Research website.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.